MillersVIP.com. Hockey season may be on ice, but Miller's VIP concert series is still heating up. Miller Lite wants you to see why Detroit still rocks. Big bands, small venues, and great beer. Get a taste of what hockey season is missing. It's VIP show number 4 with Shinedown, 3 days Grace and Cedar, coming to the Masonic Temple, downtown Detroit. Keep it locked on 101 WRIF for more details on how to win your VIP tickets. From Miller Lite, there's good enough, then there's better than it has to be. Miller. Good call. Anglers, get ready to cast your line for a big money this year because the WRAF Fishing Championship Series is coming. The series consists of 4 tournaments this year: walleye, catfish, bass, and muskie. In each tournament, anglers compete for cash and prizes, and the team with the best average finish in the 4 tournament series will also win $1,500 cash, plus the title of 2005 WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champions. After each event, competitors get to kick back and party at Big Al Sports Bar for the awards and more chances to win prizes from the Riff. The first tournament kicks off on April 23rd at the Lake Erie Metro Park for the WRIF Walleye Championship. The teams start their boats at 6:30 a.m. and will weigh their catch at 4 p.m. 2 to 3 person teams compete for thousands in cash and prizes, but one team will finish the day holding the championship trophy. To sign up or to find out about a sponsorship, call 248-591-6841 today or go to WRIF.com to get a registration form. Become the WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's Phone-In Talk Show, on 101 WRIF Detroit. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Pleasure to be with you. That was our new intro. That sounded like something that just started in the middle of things. Well, we'll check all that out. We'd like to get all that just right for you, people listening in the Detroit area, and also all of you listening on the Internet all across the world now, the United States and the rest of the world, and then listening at radiopower.org on Mondays. I think it's 9. How come I can't remember this? I think it's 9 till noon Eastern time, and then also later in the evening. So if you miss the show or miss parts of it, you can always go to radiopower.org. Also, it streams on radiopower.org besides here at WRIF.com. Phone numbers locally, or if you want to pay the dime, 313-298-WRIF. We take emails. Short ones are the ones that get read. Call talkyes@yahoo.com. And I get, I know people want to express themselves, and sometimes you can't express yourself in just a short note, but I get so many. So if you like write like 500 or 1,000 words, I'll read it on Monday, but I tend to skip over a lot. I'm sorry to say. I got to be honest with you, right? So short is better. Call talkyes@yahoo.com. My personal website is peterwerby.com, peterwerbe.com. Last name again, werbe.com. There's a chat room going on where people that are listening to the show also talk among themselves, and that's at tomhartman.com. You got to kind of follow the bouncing ball till you get to the chat room. Tom is a nationally syndicated talk show host, an old buddy of mine and colleague, and he says, yeah, sure, you can use it during this, during your show. We'll do George Carlin's Ten Commandments at about 12:50 a.m. We did it a few weeks ago, and religion and death, man, do we get to hear about anything else? I mean, it's kind of understandable with the Pope dying and all, but is it overload or what? The other thing is, there's Henry Ford II, who was Henry Ford's son, makes sense, who was called affectionately in Detroit Hank the Deuce, and Hank the Deuce was kind of a playboy and everything like that. He was always getting caught in scandals. And one of his lines that I liked was, don't complain, don't explain. In other words, just sort of stonewall people. And yet, I don't really go for that. And there was, last week, I opened the show, and I was talking about the just toxic manner in which this well-known talk show host, right-winger, naturally, was trying to pin the Terry Schiavo. Remember Terry Schiavo? That stuff goes away pretty quickly, doesn't it? The Terry Schiavo case on the left. He said something to the extent that Terry Schiavo, now the left is happy that Terry Schiavo has died. Now they will get on to saving Scott Peterson. Right? I mean, not a bit of sympathy for the family, not a bit of sympathy for the husband, not a single ounce of compassion for how this just destroyed this family and the loss that everybody suffered. But as usual, the right there, ready to make their political points off of tragedy, using, I mean, if of all the adjectives that you could use about the right, one of them, and it's not a common one, instrumentalism. In other words, using things and people and events and tragedies and for their own political purposes. Best known one, 9/11, right? But even down to the little stuff. They had their talking points. Remember, they sent around this memo saying, yeah, here, we can make some good points on this. Anyways, I incorrectly identified Scott Peterson as Terry Peterson. And I remember I wrote that down while I was driving. So I'm hearing Terry Schiavo, Terry Peterson. Doesn't make a bit of sense, but that's what stayed in my little brain. And I've got a lot in there. Got a lot of stuff packed in my head. Plus, I never paid a bit of attention to this Lacey Peterson murder. One of the reasons I don't like to do it is because you're almost forced to. You're almost forced to, just like I paid zero attention to the Pope dying, right? I'm not a Catholic. I'm not religious. So to the people that it meant a lot to, my condolences, but it didn't mean much to me. He was an older man. He had, you know, politically, that's what my concern of with what he did and said and how he acted in the world. Some of it was right-wing, some of it was left-wing. And so I appreciated the stuff where he spoke out against the material. Remember, he always spoke out against the materialism of communism. Then he spoke out against the materialism of capitalism. He spoke out against the war in Iraq. Are there other good things that he did? There must be. I they had a list of them all the time. I never paid much attention. On the other hand, with his insistence of the most conservative Catholic ideology, he probably condemned, I don't know, don't want to put a figure on it, but lots of people to death by the opposition to condiment use and to abortion. So, whatever. Anyways, let's get back to Scott Peterson. So here I am, Yak Yak, Terry Peterson. And people kindly, mostly, said, Pete, it's Scott. And, you know, they knew I was misspeaking myself. So I appreciate that. And unlike these right-wingers, I always admit when I make mistakes. And, you know, when you're talking, you're much, much more given to error because you're saying this stuff real fast. I don't like these big right-wing talk shows. They've got two or three producers. They got all these screens. And if they say, Peterson, boom, it's all up on the screen, and there's a whole synopsis of the case and all this, I'm running this off my brain. And I'm not whining or complaining or anything like that. I'm just telling you. So I have to remember all this stuff. That's okay. I mean, I enjoy doing it. Here's one person that wasn't so kind. This is, let's see, her name is Andrea, like A-N-N-D-R-E-A. I usually don't have exchanges with people. I mean, maybe once or something like that. But she was a student at U of M, is a student of U of M. And by the way, she said she got really more and more testy as this exchange went on, and finally said she wasn't going to listen anymore. So, Andrea, if you are listening, all right. Anyways, hello. First of all, it is Scott Peterson. I like how you talk about disinformation. That's what I'm always talking about, is coming out of the right wing, this disinformation. When you don't even know the name of the person in the second biggest news story over the past year. This is, to her, the second biggest news story over the past year. Now, why is this? This is because she watches television, and this is what is being presented. So it's obviously the cables as well, either CNN or Fox, or probably MSNBC as well. Not a lot of people watch those things. You know, what is it, like 1 million people watch Fox and something like 12 million people watch NBC. So I'm not watching any of them. I don't even know how the networks covered it, how much. She said, I'm a Christian and a libertarian. It annoys me. Then she goes on about the Terry Schiavo case sometimes, but she says, you and many liberals and libertarians, for that matter, keep turning everything into an anti-Christian movement. Just because some Christians think spreading hatred is okay doesn't mean all do, because that means they aren't really Christians. much in the way there are fundamentalists in every group. Fundamentalists, these are good. It goes on and on and on and on like that. I mean, I'm not trying to disparage what she's saying, but it goes on. Now she said, you pointed out numerous times how even Christians were against the war. Never said even Christians. Yet you know, yet you bash them now when some are supporting what you don't agree with. Now, I said that the only Christians I know in any group are people that are people of faith in the peace and social justice movement. So if someone said to me, give a description of Christians and how they act in the world, I would be very positive to them, given that I know a very, very narrow selection of it. Well, I wrote to her. Let's see if I should. Okay, I'll do the whole thing. And, you know, this is kind of critical of religion. If you call me, 313-298-WRIF, you think I'm being unfair. I said, Dear Andrea, I just wrote a long letter to a liberal minister who noted the long tradition of Christian activists. A pastor wrote me from Kansas. He says, from the abolitionists before the Civil War against slavery to Martin Luther King, whose faith propelled them to protest injustice. So there's a long history of Christian social activists who were trying to work in the world to do good. I know that. In fact, I say, I know that history. But I'm sorry to say those good people and those peace and social justice activists that I know in Detroit who are motivated by faith are more of a wonderful footnote to the repressive and murderous role played in general by all organized religion. Now, that's the baggage that religion brings, and it continues to this day. People of different religions killing one another. And is it any different in the Middle East? Is it any different, in India? And then you go way back into the Crusades and all that, conquistadors and all that. And I say, if your faith encourages you to be a fair and generous person, good, I guess. But I don't need belief to do so. That's me, Peter, speaking. And religion, I say, is a thin reed upon which to hang one's ethical behavior, given its mostly terrible tradition of hatred and violence perpetrated in its name. I mean, so much awful has been done in the name of religion. I was just, these soccer fans in Scotland, they said, let's have a moment of silence for the Pope. And these Protestant fans started booing and yelling because the other team was Catholic. I mean, they can't even get through a damn soccer game without some religious enmity happening. However, but let's get back to actually my main point. And I write to Andrea, your really disturbing remark is that the Peterson case is the second most important story of the year. I can't imagine, last year, I can't even imagine what she would think the first story is. If she thinks the second most important story of the year was the Lacey and Scott Peterson case. I should check out this link from my site, which is projectcensored.org. These are important stories because they affect the fate of our country, the world, and the quality of life on our planet. The rest, I say, are circuses for the masses to keep us from paying attention to what is really important. And I tell her, I'm shocked that you think private tragedies, and I would include the Peterson case, Jackson. See, I'm so out of it, man. I can't even think of his first name right now. Don't bother to email me. I will think of that. And I just keep thinking of, never mind. Michael, thank you. And the Terry Schiavo case. Private tragedies that don't affect any of us. None of our business, whether it's murder case or whatever. Awful situations. Anyways, I'm shocked that you think private tragedies are worthy of the attention by persons not involved, or that I'm remiss for not knowing the details of some murder case that occurred across the country. Why should I know anything about the Lacey Peterson case? Just another one of these terrible murders that happen all the time in this insane country, right? While we're talking, Marty writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, being from California, I am actually jealous that you were able to completely ignore the Peterson trial. I tried it, but all I had to do was go out in public and find out the latest. Right, I guess. Anyways, let's see. So I took my own advice and went to projectcensored.org. And here is Andrea telling me that the Scott Peterson, Lacey Peterson murder trial is the can't even imagine what she thought the first. I hope it was like the war in Iraq or the economy or something like that. But here are all these stories that are absolutely ignored that I know about. So she's got her shorts in an uproar because I can't correctly name the husband of or you know, somebody that apparently I guess got found guilty, right, murdered their husband. Here's number one story: wealth inequality in the 21st century threatens the economy and democracy. Number two, Ashcroft, remember him? Used to be head of the Justice Department, versus the human rights law that holds corporations accountable. On, Bush administration censors science. High levels of uranium found in troops and civilians. The wholesale giveaway of our natural resources. The sale of electoral politics. Conservative organization drives judicial appointment. On and on and on and on. New nuke plants. Taxpayers support with our tax dollars, industry profits. On endlessly. U.S. develops lethal new viruses. So, I mean, I would challenge Andrea, which is more important? And how many of those you, dear listener, knew about? I mean, you don't knew about them. I mean, you don't know about them because they're not placed significantly anywhere in the mainstream or corporate media. That's what Project Censored is all about. All right? So that's that. I said I didn't know anything. I paid absolutely zero attention to... We got some calls coming in, and Jay Hudson, our producer, will pick them up momentarily. 313-298-WRIF. One thing that did catch my eye, and then I thought maybe this was some fake. Now, I'm sorry to insult you, but let me at least be honest. You'll agree with this, except you're not about yourselves if you're religious. Religious practices are kind of strange. I mean, other people think that about other people's religion, but normally they don't think it about themselves. But this is the one thing that caught my eye. Say, I knew nothing, read none of this extensive coverage, saw not an instant of, I did. For a minute, I walked in, I said, why are all these people holding their cell phones up above the Pope, who I think was on ice? I mean, literally. You know, they used the gangster, he's on ice. Well, anyway, they all had their cell phone cameras up when they were passing the beer. Not B-E-E-R, but B, how do you spell that? B-I-E-R, where the Pope was resting. Anyways, I saw this and I thought, this has got to be a fake, but it's not. Pope's heart may rest in Poland. Now, this is not metaphorically. The city that captured the heart of, this is Krakow, the city that captured the heart of Pope John Paul II long before he followed his calling into the priesthood may become the final resting place of his physical heart. This according to a Roman Catholic Church official in Krakow. If true, I don't know how you would say this, W-A-W-E-L, Wawel, you're always safe. I mean, European language is turning the W's into V's, right? But probably I'm wrong. Wawel Cathedral, where most of the Pope's heroes, kings, and poets are buried, would be a fitting final resting place for the heart of the Pope, the poet-priest who became Pope. I mean, I don't even like to say it, but it means they're going to cut out his heart and put it in, what's that word, reliquary? Isn't that where they put relics? You know, they got like bones of saints and stuff like that. I think it's a reliquary. And they're going to put his heart in there. I mean, who's going to do that? I mean, a report in the respected Polish newspaper, I'm not even going to try that one, quoted senior Vatican sources saying that one of the Pope's last wishes had been that his heart should be buried in Krakow. I don't know. And these fake right wingers that were coming this outpouring of sympathy for the Pope. One of the worst BSers, overbearing, bullying, lying, disinformation guy, Bill O'Reilly. He says, I do know that I've studied this Pope as well as I've studied anybody. This is Bill O'Reilly now. He's one, does he have a date here? Yeah. March the 31st. I've studied this Pope as well as I've studied anybody. Probably can believe that. I mean, he's so self-centered that he probably hasn't studied anybody very well. This was a guy, by the way, that was making all these, another paragon of virtue. He's making all these salacious phone calls to one of his producers. And he kept talking about he wanted to put an loofah in her butt, right? An loofah, you mean that sponge thing? Like, And where he came up with that is way beyond me. But he kept talking about the aloof to her on the phone. They had the transcripts of it. This is why he gave her a couple million bucks or something like that. But in the transcript, he suddenly drops the word aloofah and starts talking about he wants to do her with a falafel. Now, I mean, this is, absolutely, bizarre. That's Bill O'Reilly. So anyways, I've studied this Pope as well as I've studied anybody. And I can't find anything that this guy didn't walk the walk. Great respect Bill O'Reilly has for him. You know, right down the line, nobody's perfect, but this guy was close in his personal behavior and the way he conducted himself. That's total BS. Here's what O'Reilly said on March the 15th, about 2 years ago, 2003. This is Bill O'Reilly. John Paul has sent his emissary to tell President Bush that attacking Iraq would be unjust and immoral. That's like sending Sister Mary Teresa to tell Eminem to stop cursing. Humanistically, the Pope is one of the many Saddam enablers. That's what Bill O'Reilly said about the Pope. Now he says that he's perfect. Nobody's perfect, but this guy was close, he says. What else did he say? On the 12th, a few days before, he says, I also believe that John Paul is naive and detached from reality. That's what Bill O'Reilly says about the Pope. Changed his tune a couple years later. He said he's almost perfect. 2 years ago, he said that the Pope is detached from reality. If America does not lead an attack on Iraq, once again, Saddam remains in power and is free to use his anthrax and other terrible weapons as he chooses. Summing up, Jacques Chirac is our enemy, and the Pope, well, I don't know what to think. What do you think about this guy? 313-298-WRIF, just a little more on religion. The Prince of Wales and Camilla Parker Bowles acknowledge their, quote, sins and wickedness. That's a quote, sins and wickedness, when their wedding was blessed by the Archbishop of Canterbury. And he pledged to be faithful to his new wife in the service of prayer and dedication. What? I mean, what public humiliation, eh? I got a lot of other stuff, but oh yeah. You know, Al Gore, somewhere along the line, finally got it out of himself that the election was stolen from him in 2000. That's what set in motion all of this terrible situation we find ourselves in now. In the same way, Kerry finally said many voters in last year's presidential election were denied access to the polls through trickery and intimidation on the part of the Republicans. Last year, too many people were denied their right to vote. Too many who tried to vote were intimidated, says Kerry. And he charged voting irregularities in largely Democratic areas made it difficult for voters to cast ballots in the November election. And a lawsuit in Ohio cited long lines and a shortage of voting machines in predominantly minority neighborhoods. But the Ohio Supreme Court dismissed the suit. Yeah, well, too bad. But here's what I wanted to ask you. Kerry, who's still a senator from Massachusetts, joined Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton in filing voting reform legislation. Now, they have a bill called the Count Every Vote Act, and it would create a federal holiday for voting. Imagine that, having a whole day off. So, you know, you don't have to have the sequential humiliation of being screwed at work and then coming and standing long line to choose the lesser of the two evils, right? So another federal holiday, I'm all for it. I mean, the more time off we get. American workers get such bad days off. Here, richest country in the world, again, the least amount of time off we get. All right. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby. Didn't even piss anybody off. Now, so you got a lot of open lines or stuff like that. I mean, it's not my intent. I mean, I don't want to just make people angry at me. But let's see here. I mean, we're going to come in loud and clear, says the webmaster of radiopower.org. And a question here. Your radio voice is very soothing and smooth. Were you a DJ and did you do love songs? Yeah, I'm going to go. I'm going to go on one of those stations, you know, they claim they're rock and roll stations that the audience is about 90% women. And this one's going out for Kathy. She's listening in Mount Clemens. I don't think I'm going to do that, Brian. I don't know. Wait a minute. Maybe I've tumbled onto something. All right? Okay. Here, this is, I think, okay. Brandon, it's a pretty long one. I can't really, I'm going to print it out and then read it later. But he says, I said that the good that religion does compared to the bad was really a footnote. Okay? I was being provocative, wanted to see what you had to say. I mean, trying to do all this as, and so I'll look at it a little later during our break. All right, so let's go to our phones right now. I got to be able to click. And we go to Terry listening in Dearborn. Terry, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
Great to hear you.
Thank you.
Great show as usual.
Thank you.
Now, I respect your opinion explicitly. So I want you to give me the 411, or give us listeners, or the definitive word on what the congressional investigation to the CIA's info on the weapons of mass destruction result was. I've heard only once that what they uncovered was only weapons programs, not actual weapons, and certainly no stockpiles, which leaves no doubt that the Bush administration, all the Bushies, were absolutely lying to us.
Well, that's what all of the commissions, that's what all of the on-the-ground U.S. military divisions, I forgot how many millions and millions and millions were spent with our tax dollars hoping they could actually come up with something. I mean, on the face of it, I can't believe that they believe that they really think, because the American memory is about 2.5 days, if we're lucky, that once this got going, that people would either forget about it or think, hey, we're stuck there. There's not much we can do. Yeah, maybe they lied. Maybe they were just a bunch of bozos, because it's one of two things. I don't know what Republicans could say. Either the people that put this all together were total bozos and misread all of this information. One of the main informants was someone that the CIA gave the code name of Curveball.
But he was in another country, right? Wasn't he?
No, he I don't know where he, but he hadn't been in Iraq for a very long time. And he was known by his friends as a pathological liar, and he was told by other services to ignore it. Well, I mean, they had planned to invade Iraq since 1998. They were simply waiting for the appropriate moment when they could invade Iraq. I mean, it was all part of a political and imperial scheme to pose the president as a war president, to make people forget about things like the economy, to sacrifice tens of thousands of Iraqi lives and thousands of American lives in order to give U.S. control of world oil, anticipating correctly, it's one of the few things that they're correct about, that control of world oil at a time when countries are going to start to be scrambling for it, because we're reaching a period where we're going to hit what's called peak oil production. Then it starts running out. I mean, you got your maximum, then it runs out. So you say, hey, why not? Why don't we control it? We don't control it. Who's going to control it? Like the people who live there or something like that. Well, the deal is we should be getting our butts off of oil completely, and we ought to have a crash program like a Manhattan project, like we used to develop the atom bomb. I mean, that kind of rush to develop the technology and the conservation and what have you, so we don't have to destroy pristine Alaskan territory. We don't have to go to wars. We don't have to destroy other people's countries.
To me, this proves conclusively, though, doesn't it, that they did lie, they made this up, at the CIA wasn't giving them the information on the stockpiles, the thousands of tons, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
That they had to have made it up. No question.
Well, let's do this, because I think they lied. I think they intentionally lied. I think they intentionally have absolute contempt, arrogant contempt for the American people, and think they can say or do anything. And when these people screw up magnificently, like allowing September 11th to occur, invading a country that represented no threat whatsoever to the United States or anyone in the area, everyone involved gets promoted. You know, Condoleezza Rice, who completely ignored the pleadings of Richard Clark, the National Security Advisor, to convene a meetings about the terrorist threat. She completely ignored him, so she gets made Secretary of State. A man who goes to the Colin Powell goes to the UN and just lets off tons of nonsense. He retires in with honors, and the rest of them, they get medals. They get Wolfowitz, Paul Wolfowitz, who was one of the big promoters of this war. He becomes head of the World Bank. I mean, I'll tell you, you get bad ratings in radio, you're out of there. If you're a salesman somewhere and you don't sell, you get fired. If you're working on a production line and you keep missing your little part of things because you're too slow or you don't come in, you're out of there. Where's the penalty for these magnificent screw-ups that are heading this government? I mean, they're a pack of losers. They lose elections and they steal them. They allow the most catastrophic attack on America ever occurred in our history. They start wars for no purpose whatsoever. They can't catch the main perpetrator of it all. Remember, we're going to get them wet, dead or alive. You know. We'll be right back.
Listening WRIF.com. Anglers, get ready to cast your line for a big money this year because the WRIF Fishing Championship Series is coming. The series consists of four tournaments this year: walleye, catfish, bass, and muskie. In each tournament, anglers compete for cash and prizes, and the team with the best average finish in the four tournament series will also win $1,500 cash, plus the title of 2005 WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champions. After each event, competitors get to kick back and party at Big Al Sports Bar for the awards and more chances to win prizes from the RIF. The first tournament kicks off on April 23rd at the Lake Erie Metro Park for the WRIF Walleye Championship. The teams start their boats at 6:30 a.m. and will weigh their catch at 4 p.m. Two to three-person teams compete for thousands in cash and prizes, but one team will finish the day holding the championship trophy. To sign up or to find out about a sponsorship, call 248-591-6841 today or go to WRIF.com to get a registration form. Become the WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
Hockey season may be on ice, but Miller's VIP concert series is still heating up. Miller Lite wants you to see why Detroit still rocks. Big bands, small venues, and great beer. Get a taste of what hockey season is missing. It's VIP show number 4 with Shinedown, 3 days grace, and Seether, coming to the Masonic Temple, downtown Detroit. Keep it locked on 101 WRIF for more details on how to win your VIP tickets. From Miller Lite, there's good enough, then there's better than it has to be. Miller. Good call. This is WRIF.com.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Shields, ideal for business lunches and family dinners, with locations in Southfield, Troy, Dearborn, Commerce Township, and their newest location in Warren. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
Rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Two for Tuesday on 101 WRIF.
Riff Rocks.
Like what you hear on the riff? then why not get your Riff Rock to go?
Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock.
A night of black leather, hot bands, great food, wicked bikes, and more. Plus, you can bid on a 2005 Harley-Davidson Fatboy. The 6th annual MDA Black and Blue Ball. May 6th at the Ritz-Carlton in Dearborn. Call for tickets at 586-274-9000. From Ford Motor Company, Motor City Harley-Davidson, Pepsi Bottling Group, and 101 WRIF.
Footnote. Does it. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Jay, give me an idea of what's next. Another one of those damn anti-war marches. Protesters call for U.S. pullout in Iraq. How come these Americans aren't supporting our boys over there? Huh? Protesters call for U.S. pullout. Oh, these are Iraqis. These are the people we came to liberate. Tens of thousands of supporters of a Shiite cleric filled central Baghdad streets Saturday and demanded that American soldiers go home, making the second anniversary of Baghdad's fall with shouts of no, no to Satan. That'd be us, right? So, we're spending, let me see, did I put down here? Yeah, we have spent $162 billion of our tax dollars. That's how much you and I have spent collectively. $162 billion. And that, you can go, let me see, costofwar.com. One of the nice things about this site, it allows you to see what this could have been spent on in our neighborhood rather than the neighborhoods over there, although I don't think much is getting reconstructed. Who knows where this stuff is, what kind of rat hole this is going down of Halliburton and Bechtel and all those companies like that. Even in a little city of Ramadi, 5,000 protesters came out, same thing. Tens of thousands of people spilled into the streets of central Baghdad, waving Iraqi flags, climbing onto an abstract structure said to represent freedom and built on the spot where Saddam Hussein's statue was. Which, never mind about that. But anyway, so we're over there. We attacked this country with absolutely no justification whatsoever, built on lies or mistakes. Either way, these people should have been out of office. And this is a pretty serious mistake. And if it's a lie, it's even more horrid. But let's see. Bush, hey, get this. U.S. to bear burden of Iraq costs. Well, duh. And if you're ringing on the phone right now, Jay Hudson, our producer, will be right with you. And you're giving up too early, some of you. Just keep ringing. We'll get you. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. So Bush says, this is Bush, standing alongside visiting President Viktor Yushchenko. And he's pulling his troops out. He's out of there. He promised that. The fundamental question is, this is what Bush said, is it worth it? And the answer is, absolutely, it's worth it for a free Iraq to emerge. This is what he says. Bush says, it's worth $162 billion so far. So far. And it's going to be a tremendous amount more. All right. We have open lines at 313-298-WRIF, if you're on the line, patients, and we'll pick you up in just a second. 2 years after the U.S.-led invasion toppled Saddam Hussein, the coalition has been crumbling. Dozens of countries have pulled out or begun bringing their troops home, something we should do immediately as well, I would say. Now, Bush says, well, that's it. I'll ask you, is it worth it? Let's say this costs $250 billion. For one thing, we wouldn't be having any argument about Social Security, would we? That would pay for it all. So we wouldn't have to have this discussion. Or it could pay for lots of other things. Like, we wouldn't have to be cutting back on all these programs for the poor. Wouldn't have to be voting like the Republicans are to kick hundreds of thousands of people off of food stamps. Mostly kids, of course. Wouldn't have to be looking at legislation that would cut medical services for hundreds of thousands of elderly people. But Bush says, yes, is it worth it? He says, absolutely. It's worth it for a free Iraq. And in the meantime, tens of thousands of Iraqis are in Baghdad saying, get out! He says, we're not getting out. We're not going to get out. Let me see, where is it? I can't remember where his quote is. But we're going to force the occupation to leave from our country, read one banner in English. But Bush says he will not pull out troops from Iraq until the security situation has improved. So it doesn't matter what the Iraqis think. Doesn't matter how many Iraqis come to say, your sacrifices aren't what we want. We want you out. It matters what George Bush says. Also, I mean, all this this terrible situation in Darfur. More than 2 million Darfuris have fled their homes during 26 months of this just almost genocide that's going on, and they're running out of food. Food rations have to be cut for more than 1 million Darfuris who have been fled fighting to makeshift camps in the region because of a drastic shortage of funds, according to the World Food Programs. If we're not going to use the money on ourselves, shouldn't we at least use it for humanitarian efforts? 313-298-WRIF. Let me just take a quick look here. We'll check the old mail. And, sound levels, always around. Again, why am I listening over the internet? Your voice is right up there in the speaker. Your telephone callers are harder to hear, not the same volume or something sort of faded into the background. Do any of your staff ever monitor the program over the internet? Love your show. Sarah Kay says that. Yeah, maybe I'm not putting them up high enough. And again, the commercial break overlapped. Technology. Okay, we'll contact our engineers again. Jay, where's our next caller, please? Give me an idea, will you? 313-298-WRIF. All right, hearing nothing from that room, I'll just take the person that's been waiting the longest. It's Maurice from Inkster. Maurice, hi. Yep, wait a minute. Wrong one. Hi, you're on the air. No, that didn't work. Let me try it again. Maurice, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Doing good.
I just want to say, I think the Pope was a great man. You know, everybody have trouble in their house, and I think that asshole in Washington can learn a little bit from him.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty, you know, they sent one of these people over there, this Cardinal Law from Boston, who had been kicked out of office as the Archbishop because he had let all these molesters continue on as priests.
And can I tell you something? My friend's girlfriend used to work in the Archdiocese of Detroit.
Yeah.
I mean, you've probably seen the different people in Detroit being asked about the things that are going on.
Yeah.
Without permission from the Vatican, they cannot speak upon unless they're given permission to speak.
Huh.
That's how it works.
Well,
and
I know.
Like, you cannot speak about that stuff on the job. You say you miss anything about that, they automatically fire you.
Well, yeah, it's not exactly like it's a democratic organization or anything like that. Orders come from the top. All right, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Continuing onward, here's Dave from Oakland. Dave, hi. Peter Werby, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Well, listen, I just wanted to make a comment. You know, you're starting to scare me because, as you recall, we had a little conversation outside your gate a few months ago, and I told you I disagreed with you 80% of the time, and now I'm finding I am agreeing with you about 80% of the time.
This is Deputy Dave.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so, yeah, I just wondering, your show maybe 3-4 weeks ago was on Political Association. You were talking about, just different forms of, you know, how people form government and things like that. Do you recall that show?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to. Have you ever heard of John Rawls?
I'm sorry, what?
John Rawls. He's a political philosopher.
Okay.
And I believe that his book is A Theory of Justice, and it expounds upon the original position of how you would choose if you didn't know what type of wealth or health that you would be born into, what type of political association would you choose, not knowing.
Okay.
So it's something, you know, to think about. Maybe you want to, you know, read that book because it really, you know, I think a lot of people would choose a different form that would be fundamentally fair to everybody.
Well, do me a favor, Dave. Send an email to calltalkyes@yahoo.com because I did not write it down. So I'd like to check it out as well. So what's changed that you've 80% different. Am I different or are you different?
No, it's probably me. I'm just getting older. And well, since I've been listening to you since probably, I think, about 75, 78, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah, at least that long now.
You're not on duty right now?
No.
Okay, well, I guess I shouldn't press you if you are. All right, well, thanks for listening.
Yeah, keep up the good work. We, you know, like the lady said out there, you know, as far as the Scott Peterson, how could you possibly keep up on all the information? You know, you've got to research the important stuff, and, you know, we'll catch the other stuff as it comes along.
All right, thanks, Dave.
All right, take care.
Appreciate it. All right, listening in Santa Cruz, California, a city I always love to visit, Xavier, you're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to do a real brief thing here. I just thought George Bush, pull out like your father should have.
I got that. Talk about recycling, man. That's like. Now, hey Xavier, when my show used to come into Santa Cruz, did you on my daily show? Did you hear it then?
You know, I'm from Michigan. I've been out here for about 20 years.
Yeah.
I used to listen to your show back then, and. I just found out about you about a year ago.
And no.
I was listening on White Rose, and now I'm streaming it on Radio Power.
Yeah, well, I worked for an ill-fated network called IE America, and one of our affiliates was the Santa Cruz station with some idiot who got mad because I wouldn't appear on his show. I mean, we had all these affiliates, and he wanted me to be a guest on his show every Saturday.
Oh, okay.
I can't even remember the name of, KOMY.
KOMY, yeah, I know those
things. I used to call it Commie Radio, and he was a conservative,
yeah.
And I said, it's not Commie Radio? But I forgot what happened. He finally, in a fit, he's... You're out of here.
Yeah. Well, listen, I got one other point to make here.
Sure.
We don't have it up yet, but me and a few other people are working on a group called Patriotic Resistance.
Sure.
And what we're doing is we're basically, in Santa Cruz, California, things are pretty progressive, and we can, you know, write our Congress people, but they're already online with what we're trying to do. So what we're doing is we're projecting political consciousness from where it is to where it's needed. We're basically... helping out people in seats that are like close to teetering. Like I think this Tom DeLay is a prime candidate for getting people like that out. So that's what we're going to be doing.
Well, good.
I'll keep you posted on it.
Hey Xavier, there's another. Actually, we used to get a caller even here in Detroit, Billy from Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to that big guy?
You know, I may know him, but I can't place him by his voice. And I don't know if that's his real name or not. But
well, he used to. I can't remember the town. Just a little south.
Santa Cruz. Yeah, he's supposedly from Santa Cruz, and I've heard him on Tom Hartman not too long ago.
Okay, he's about 6'5", and he drives a white Mercedes.
Holy cow!
All right, thanks, Xavier.
Thanks a lot.
Appreciate it. Thanks for calling in from Santa Cruz, California. 313-298-WRIF. It's Blake. Blake's calling from Canton. Hey, Blake. It's Peter Werby.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I just want to say that I've had surgery on my arms and legs after a bad accident.
Whoa.
The show kind of gets me through the therapy and stuff.
Well, good. How, man.
And I report at the night.
You know, a while ago, I mean, quite a while ago, I used to really have a lot of anxiety about flying. I mean, you know, thinking about flying and then even going up in them. And now my anxiety about flying is around zero, and it is building about automobile travel.
Yeah, well, I'm a street racer, but I don't do it illegally. I do all sanctioned events.
Yeah? Did you get hurt in a sanctioned event?
Yeah, I was going around the corner, and I upshifted too fast, and I guess my right wheel came up, and the guard just went into the wall.
Wow. That's tough,
man.
Instead
of using a stock seatbelt, I bought a harness, and it held me in the seat, so only, I guess that's what got me out alive.
Well, good. The body, man. What can happen to it?
I have a crazy story for you. This is true, honest to God.
Tell me.
My friend, I work at Soromatic Precision Machining. It's I don't know the whereabouts of it. It's in Warren. But anyways, we were at lunch, and I was like, because my buddy, he's a Christian. I was like, did you hear the Pope die? And this is true. He says, you can't believe everything you see on TV. I bet he's still alive.
Well, the only thing that happened, I mean, the Fox News reported about 26 hours ahead of time that he died, but I think he's gone.
It flipped me out to hear him say that.
Yeah. You know, one thing that's interesting, where there was a lot of anti-Catholic sentiment among Protestants. I mean, for one thing, the Ku Klux Klan, the people they hated in this order were blacks and Jews and then Catholics. And they always they had a lot of hostility towards Catholics and what they called popery, you know, P-O-P-E-R-Y.
Yeah.
And even in Detroit, like in the 1920s, that on the east side, that was where the trade union people were and the immigrants who were mostly Catholic, Polish and Irish and what have you. And they had these very, very progressive liberal mayors that they elected, like Frank Murphy, who wound up finally on the Supreme Court. And then on the west side, that was where the Detroit Ku Klux Klan had all of its strength. And one of the charges that they made, of course, was that that these liberals were controlled by the Vatican. Yeah. So these people ought to take their religion seriously, I would say. Okay, thank you. Hey, Blake, get better soon. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. We've been having lots of difficulties here, and I have to say, I'll tell you now, maybe even some of you listen real, real close could hear it in my voice. I thought I should have known better that our producer, Jay Hudson, was remiss in not letting me know on our little system here who was next and all that. But he came in here and he says, what, I can't get it on the screen. What's going on here? So we don't know that. I want to go back. Some of you may remember when the producer of this show was on the other side of a glass and would hold up. We had numbers on pieces of paper, 1 through 6. And when it was, and sometimes just fingers. You go, 3, that worked. What do we need all this for? Anyways, let me see. So I'm not seeing anything. I'm just going to go with the person who has been on here the longest. It's Ingram from Jackson. Ingram, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Hey, I'm considering taking like a local mayor position or just some kind of getting some kind of office position.
Yeah?
And I'm just considering asking you, what do you feel about the distribution center for marijuana that would be a legal thing for the ones that have, like, a license to carry the position to have it for something for a legalization.
Well, I don't think it's going to get you elected mayor, but...
No. Well, no, in a liberal town, you never know.
Jackson?
You know, like Ann Arbor, yeah, I mean, yeah, I think WIF shows up at the local Ann Arbor Hash Bash every year, don't they?
I don't know. I was out there one time with Drew and Mike and
yeah,
Trudy.
I've been there a few years back, but not in local... You know, not in the local years.
I missed it for the last couple as well. Yeah.
No, actually, what's your feeling about something like that?
Well, fine. I mean, I think I'm completely libertarian when it comes to drugs, even the so-called bad ones. That the function of a government is to give people the straight information. In other words, they say you can't smoke flowers and change your consciousness, but you can take all these other hideous drugs that marijuana, which no one's ever died from, as opposed to these pharmaceuticals that there's thousands of overdoses on them a year, and then it turns out that we're told that these are so good for us, will help us, and then we find out that a whole class of drugs, in fact, lead to heart attacks and stuff like that. So how in the world FDA drugs can be legal with all the lethal characteristics they frequently have and benign substances that hurt no one, the users are turned into criminals. If anything, if people have problems with them, obviously, they should be able to seek medical help or psychological help or whatever they think. But it ought to be a sympathetic community for people with problems. If the vast majority of people who use drugs are users and not abusers. But for the people that abuse anything from food to alcohol to cigarettes to drugs to whatever, ought to have a sympathetic and not a punitive community waiting for them. All right, thank you. Good luck on your political aspirations, I guess. Okay, we'll be right back.
If you think it's too late in life to earn the college degree you want, listen to this. Now you can go to a college designed for busy working adults. It's University of Phoenix, the nation's largest private accredited university. In most cases, you can earn a bachelor's or master's degree in just 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classroom settings are designed for working adults with busy lives. With their efficient learning model, you'll cover more material in less time, going to convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. For a complimentary brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more, call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Classes are forming, so call now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391. Anglers, get ready to cast your line for a big money this year because the WRAF Fishing Championship Series is coming. The series consists of four tournaments this year: walleye, catfish, bass, and muskie. In each tournament, anglers compete for cash and prizes, and the team with the best average finish in the four tournament series will also win $1,500 cash, plus the title of 2005 WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champions. After each event, competitors get to kick back and party at Big Al Sports Bar for the awards and more chances to win prizes from the RIF. The first tournament kicks off on April 23rd at the Lake Erie Metro Park for the WRAF Walleye Championship. The teams start their boats at 6:30 a.m. and will weigh their catch at 4 p.m. Two- to three-person teams compete for thousands in cash and prizes, but one team will finish the day holding the championship trophy. To sign up or to find out about a sponsorship, call 248-591-6841 today or go to WRIF.com to get a registration form. Become the WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today.
WRIF.com. A night of black leather, hot bands, great food, wicked bikes, and more. Plus, you can bid on a 2005 Harley Davidson Fat Boy, 6th annual MDA Black and Blue Ball.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour of Night Call. We're streaming across the world on WRIF.com and radiopower.org. This program will be repeated, including the interviews that will occur at 1 a.m. Eastern Time tomorrow on radiopower.org, and then they will be archived at whiterosesociety.org. If you missed all this, go to my website, Peter Werby, PeterWerbe.com. And let's see how my memory is doing. Can I remember who I'm interviewing? Oh, yeah. A woman who wrote a kind of a detective novel. There's this genre, this type of film and novel called film noir, N-O-I-R, which means black. And it's these, you know, like Lethal Weapon, you know, now, or Mickey Spillane books, or you know, some of these Humphrey Bogart movies, stuff like that. And the role, you know, stuff like gender roles and all, I think it's pretty interesting. And then Christopher Phillips, who runs something called Socrates Cafes, And Socrates, the philosopher, posed a lot of questions about what constitutes justice, what constitutes, you know, the big ones, the big questions of defining life. And, all right, anyways, that's at 1 a.m., so that's in about an hour or so. One of the things that's always occurring to me is that we complain about a lot of things. I mean, right now, the majority of people think that the war in Iraq was a mistake. I don't know whether they think, wouldn't that be interesting? I've never seen any polls as to whether they think Bush was lying or just dumb, that all these people in office were dumb. Because I knew there were no weapons of mass destruction, and most of you did. That, listen, at least what I get from you when you call or when you have written me. You can write, by the way, at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. So if we knew there were no weapons of mass destruction, and we only went, I mean, I wasn't over there. But you could read in the daily papers, if you looked closely enough and looked at the what was being presented on both sides, it was pretty clear that this was a fabrication. Because everything that we found out subsequently, these millions of taxpayer dollars that went into these commissions to find why was there an intelligence failing? Well, they can go on forever why there was, but we knew there was. And the same conclusions that they came to in these 600-page studies are stuff you would have heard on this show in 2003. I mean, it was all a scam. It was all a political scam. But anyways, more scams. Here, this U.S. agency forecasts higher gas prices. There's pump shock at every corner gas station with prices well over $2 a gallon and still rising. And the government says, you better get used to it. That'd be George W. Bush, right? He's the guy that said, remember, no one's, I don't know if people are going to answer this. He asked, the fundamental question, is the Iraq war worth it? And he said, absolutely. Even though he says, we're going to have to pick up all the tab. Remember we had the coalition of the billing, the ones that thought they're going to get cut in on the racket. Some of them have. They got, U.S. bases, and we wound up paying these folks tons of money. Whole cost of the war so far, $162 billion, and yet more and more things going wrong with this country that begging for money. Go to costofwar.com, and you'll see the stats, wherever you live, too. So anyways, so Bush says, get used to it. He doesn't care. I mean, if you think about it, the wealthier you are, it really doesn't matter. For instance, now they're talking, too, about raising the price of stamps. Another 2 cents. That's, what the hell? 2 cents. What does that matter? But it all depends on where you're sitting in the economic heap. Well, if you're a rich kid from a rich family, frat rat Bush, it doesn't matter much to you. Gas could go $9 a gallon, and it wouldn't affect him in the slightest. But when it goes up 50 cents a gallon, I mean, I drove to Ann Arbor and back, and I have to say, you can beat me up for this. My car does not get great gas mileage. I figured it probably cost me about $8 or something like that. Maybe not that much. $6-$7 just to drive to Ann Arbor. I guess I'm positioned, so it doesn't hurt me that badly. It doesn't help. But if you're making like $18,000, $19,000 a year, and you've got to drive 20 miles to work, that hurts. You just worked an hour for ExxonMobil. Yeah, that's where it all went. And all these companies are making record profits. So it's not like, and it is, of course, the cost of a barrel of oil is going up. But the profits that they are realizing, the big oil companies, is disproportionate. It's absolutely disproportionate to what they're charging us. So they're looting us. It's a ripoff. The mighty Jim Hughes has just entered the building. Jim, you're just staring at me? It's okay. I can handle it. All right. The Energy Department projects high gasoline prices, $50 plus crude oil at least through next year as producers struggle to keep up with demand. Is that it? Gasoline prices went up to $2.35. I just, on the way in, saw $2.17, so it went down a little. So it's a rip. Now, some of you go to commondreams.org, and it's a link on my site as well, peterwerby.com. And there was an article by Michael Clare, Professor Michael Clare. Where does he teach? Somewhere out east or something like that. Hampshire College in Massachusetts, yeah. And he has written an article there on March 22nd called The Energy Crunch to Come, Soaring Oil Profits, Declining Discoveries, and Danger Signs. The worldwide decline in new discoveries, he goes on about this, is right in the middle of it, has profound implications for the global supply of energy and, by extension, the world economy. Given a recent surge in energy demand from China and other rapidly developing countries, the U.S. Department of Energy predicts that for all future energy needs to be satisfied, total world oil output will have to climb by 50% between now and 2025. Now, they're discovering less and less. Where they do discover it, it doesn't have as much as they think. Stuff like the Alaska oil fields has, when they can get it finally somewhere, it'd be like almost 10 years. And what is it called? Something crude, rough crude, something. It's not even really what you want. Anyways, they need a staggering increase in global production, which would be an extra 40 million barrels per day and would be the equivalent of the total world daily consumption in 1969. Without major new discoveries, however, the global oil industry will likely prove incapable of providing all of this additional energy. Without massive new oil discoveries, prices will rise, supplies will dwindle, and the world economy will plunge into recession, or worse. What could be worse? Well, wars. If all of our economies, particularly ours and China's, is dependent upon fossil fuel, and that's what the geniuses in the Bush administration began this war against Iraq for, to control that Middle East oil. And believe me, somewhere deep in their plans, they're talking about overthrowing the Saudi government as well. It's to control oil. And you say, hey, cool. We'll be the ones calling the tune. Remember Waterworld? Yeah, when there was the whole world was covered with water, and that water was the most precious substance. Well, oil would be the same thing. But the only thing is, when there's this not even a demand, but this absolute necessity for oil, that spells one thing: war, oil war. So we better get our butts off of that, and quick is what I say. And these maniacs that are controlling our destinies right now aren't the people to handle this. All right, let's go to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. It's Bruce in Sterling Heights. Hey, Bruce. It's Peter Werby.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing good.
Well, good pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
I apologize if you guys already talked about this, but I just feel that there's kind of a lack of acknowledgement at how the Catholic Church should take responsibility for the spread of AIDS. By their teaching of anti-contraception and things like that. I personally feel I have no, obviously, the double-blinded studies to back this up. But, you know, I would just kind of guess that they're responsible for tens of thousands of deaths a year due to AIDS simply by their teachings.
Well, I would agree with that, and that's the sad truth of it. That's the right-wing side of the church. I mean, on one hand, they're against the death penalty. They're against... against the war in Iraq, and on the other hand, stopping people from stopping teaching about birth control have condemned probably thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions. Who knows?
Some people would argue that, oh, how can the Catholic Church be responsible for AIDS and whatnot? Now, I would argue not to. I don't mean to speak down about the African people at all, but you know, a lot of the African or some of the African population do believe things like if you sleep with a virgin, this cures AIDS. Now, when you take someone with that sort of mentality and you have a huge, quote-unquote, moral authority telling them that do not use contraception, you know, they're not gonna, based on what this quote-unquote, moral authority has told them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I personally hold the Catholic, particularly the Catholic Church and their power, absolutely responsible for thousands of dead babies every year.
All right. Thank you, Bruce. We'll see what other people have to say about that one. Appreciate your call. Here is Rich writing in from Boulder, Colorado. He's listening online. He says, sad to hear about Blake, the guy who's laid up from an auto accident, but it's no surprise considering the fact that an average of 3 million people are maimed each year on American highways. That's not to mention 43 Americans killed each year in automobile accidents, and there is more killing for it in overseas wars. You often ask pro-war folks who call your show how many lives lost in Iraq is too many. Yeah, they never answer, do they? I ask you the same question. How many lives lost due to the automobile is too many? He says cars are killers. Bicycles are peaceful, sustainable machines. Bikeforpeace.org. Yeah, I mean, one of the things, if we built cities with some human purpose in mind, we could probably reduce travel by tens of millions of miles a year. And obviously, the more we travel, the more it ups the rate of potential for accident. But when we have these cities where that no one, I mean, I can't walk anywhere. Actually, I can walk to work. But sort of the way the city's out. I mean, I have done it sometimes, but it's not even really good for that. Other people here drive 30, 40, 50 miles, maybe even more to get here. And what we need, of course, is cities and job, recreation, shopping that has the ability for us to walk that has great public transportation and creates the context for a face-to-face community. That's another thing the automobile destroys. But I forgot, and maybe Rich can write back if you're still listening in Boulder, that how many people have been killed by automobiles since their introduction. I mean, it's in the millions. Let me take a guess. Let me say it's, I'll really lowball it. I think it's much, much higher. In fact, if somebody can Google it for me, just go to Google and say, how would you put it? Automobile deaths. I don't know. You figured it. And if someone said, hey, I got a new machine, it's really going to be kind of cool and do all this and help people, and you go, hey, man, that's great. Any downside to it? Yeah, it's going to kill a million people. You go, oh, wait a minute. I don't think we're going to do this. So if people could have seen into the future, the impact that automobiles have and the internal combustion engine in general are going to have, that a sensible society never even would have allowed it to be introduced. Now, I've had cool cars. I go to the Woodward Dream Cruise. When I was in Cuba, I just loved seeing all these old American cars there. And typical Detroit boy, to some extent a love affair with the cars. But on the other hand, these things are damn dangerous. I mean, I know, like most of us. I mean, think about this. Most of us know someone, or at least once removed, people that were killed in automobile accidents that were severely injured. Remember, I told you that at least two people seriously, gravely injured to the point where last year where they're not even recovered. One person I knew killed at least. And, and even with all the safety improvements, still, they're just these murderous machines. But as it stands now, I don't know what the hell we're going to do to get rid of them. And but also culturally, I mean, I expect to when I want to be able to drive to Ann Arbor, to drive up north, to drive to Montreal, to drive to Chicago, to drive to New York City. I mean, a lot of times I fly, but sometimes, yeah, I've driven to California and back. I've driven to Florida and back, and we expect that culturally. And to have that reduced in our lives would seem like a deprivation, wouldn't it? All right, let's move on. Hi, you're on the air, and I'm kind of missing your name. Is it Elia?
Elia. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Elia.
Long-time listener. I started back when I was 16, and I was at least, and I'm 21 now.
Welcome.
I got just a few points. First of all, I find it kind of funny that you have on the right these people who are pro-death penalty, and then anti-abortion, and people on the left who are anti-death penalty, pro-abortion, kind of the hypocrisy in that.
Why is that hypocritical? I don't understand. I mean, first off, nobody's pro-abortion. I'm not pro-abortion. What I support is the right to women, if they choose, to have abortions. Anything else is compulsory pregnancy. And abortions have been carried out, and since every human record we have is that society's practiced abortion even before medical technology, and abortion is directly related to questions of poverty. I mean, as it is, the majority of women who get abortions in the United States are married women, and generally carried out for economic reasons. So one of the ways, for abortions in the last 10 years or so have dropped by about 40% to begin with, and we could drop them significantly in the United States and worldwide if there was social and economic justice.
Well, that and just, something other than abstinence in our sex ed education. But when I say hypocrisy, I mean things where basically they're just using these things to further their agenda. They're not actually... If you take a look at what they're saying, it's so far gone from what they believe.
Okay.
Number two is your comment about getting out of Iraq. Now, I agree with you completely in the fact that we should not have gone in there. It's true that Saddam Hussein was a despicable person, but... you know, the war was, we went in there for all the wrong reasons. We were lied to get into it. But the fact remains that we are in it now. And if we pull out, you know, completely and leave the country, we have a very strong possibility of basically creating another Afghanistan where some kind of group will come into power, like the Taliban, and you have more people like Osama bin Laden who come into power and just create terror. We'll use the fact that we came in, you know, got rid of whatever, and then just left it.
Well, then, if you advocate staying in Iraq, you have to have some sort of what they call cost-benefit analysis. So, according to you, the benefit will be that we could eventually, who knows how many years, produce a stable democratic nation that would not be hostile to the United States. So then the cost. There's cost benefit. The benefit is that it would work out eventually work well for the United States' interests. The cost, though, is increasing deaths on the part of United States soldiers, increasing deaths on the part of Iraqi civilians, and an expenditure of tax dollars. So, Elliot, then you, I think, have the obligation to tell us how many American lives are you willing to expend. And I suspect, being 21, that even though you have the opportunity to take part in that, you're not going to. And how many Iraqi lives and how much money?
The thing is, I don't believe that we can just pull out completely, but the whole policy, the current war is a farce.
Yeah.
You know, how it's carried out. Like you said, our allies are pulling out. They're not going to be funding this war. The whole war is a farce. The war, the mentality behind the war needs to be completely overhauled, and the whole policy needs to be completely changed, where this is a unified action, where we listen to the Iraqi people. It's not us just going in and killing. It's
I agree. In large sections of the Iraqi people, it was mostly Sunnis, I think, who demonstrated yesterday, with tens of thousands of them demonstrating in Baghdad and Ramadi and other places, telling the U.S. to withdraw from there. But also, many, many of the candidates that were on the Shiite line also want American withdrawal. So, but one of the things that it's almost, people almost think of it like a trick question when I say, how many American lives are you willing to say yes to being lost before it's too many? I mean, right now it's over 1,500. How about 2,000, 3,000, 10,000? We lost almost 60,000 in Vietnam. I mean, if I said to you, this is what you're talking about is going to cost 60,000 American lives, would you do it? Would you say yes, go for it?
It's a tough question. Life lost is never, you know, a good thing. But
yeah. Well, it's not going to be yours, Elliot, because you're 21. You could just trot your butt right down to the recruitment center, right? A lot of those guardsmen who are getting killed are 42 and 43 years old, don't want to be over there. Some of them serving their second, even their third term. So I think that there's an obligation on the part of people that support this kind of activity and are able to do so to be part of it. I mean, you don't want other people to die for you, do you? That's a tough question, too. All right, think about it. Call me back some other time. I'm remiss in not mentioning this earlier because, I mean, this is a rock and roll station, and we play all rock and roll, except sometimes I see other forms of music and understand what it must have been like at different times. And the rebellious nature of that characterizes a lot of rock and roll still was present in some of the classical music, for instance. Some of it was, you know, kind of stodgy and done for the lords and all that, but others of it weren't. But last night, my wife and I and some friends went to the Detroit Opera House to see the Michigan Opera Theater presentation of Tosca. Man, this was absolutely incredible. Everything from the vocals to the scenery was just so amazing. The scenery was so spectacular that in the three acts, when the curtain rose, the audience applauded the scenery. Tosca is an amazing story of love and adventure, political prisoners, you know, evil counts, the way these, you know, the way these the dramas that are part of the opera usually is, are rather. And I thought, so I told my wife, I said, man, I'm going to get on the air and tell people that they ought to check this out. Tuscan, she said, damn, these seats are expensive, though, Pete. You know, they're expensive. But, you know, I thought they're no different than a rock concert. I mean, it's not a little, some of them even the sort of second tier acts. It's like, if you want good seats, like a first tier rock act. And, you know, this thing was 3 hours longer than a rock concert often. So, Tosca, Michigan Opera Theater at the Detroit Opera House, which is an experience in and of itself. All right, that done. Let's go back to our phones. And, okay, we're having our problems again, so I can't tell where our next caller is. But let me go to our one who, whoa, boy, Bill's been waiting a long time. I'm going to get Bill. Bill, waiting in West Bloomfield. Thanks for your patience. You're on the air.
Good evening, Peter. Just
hi.
Was listening to your broadcast with considerable interest regarding the current Iraq debacle that we're in, especially talking about the financial impact upon the country. I mean, being a Republican myself, just barely, really, it's really a debacle. There's no other way to frame it. But one thing I think should be considered is the effect of foreign countries and or foreign agendas in our foreign policy, our own foreign policy. For example, the president and the government, of course, they don't work in a vacuum. But if you look at why we're in Iraq, why we should or should not be in Iraq, certainly is not, I don't think, the product of just the president or his cronies considering oil and things along that nature.
Mm-hmm.
But we have, for example, various countries that, of course, have their own agendas, and sometimes they wish the United States to be the instrument to bring those about. And really what I'm speaking about is, in this case, the country of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And this is strictly, let me preface this, this is a political discussion. There's no room here for religion or racism or any of that stuff. We're just talking about what the country of Israel, what their agenda is, and how it affects the United States. You spoke briefly about Paul Wolfowitz, a war criminal if there ever was one, now being promoted to the head of the World Bank. Given that every prediction he had about the Iraqi conflict, nearly everyone's been wrong. Wolfowitz, Douglas Feist, you may be familiar with,
sure,
Undersecretary for Policy. These guys are trying to neocons. And, Feist, actually the CIA listed him in the early mid-80s as a lobbyist for AIPAC as an agent of Israel. Recently,
well, he's also, his brother heads a law firm in Tel Aviv, and one of the partners is connected to this the Chalabi family, who was the CIA's point man. Well, you know, actually, this comes up frequently, the connection. I mean, Israel in many ways has given its policies towards the Palestinians and its refusal to stop the occupation of the West Bank. It finds itself in the midst of a hostile region. I mean, hostile because of the way it's functioned over the years. And yet the idea, for instance, that men in the office or in the government of the United States could have a personal agenda that's split between United States interest and Israeli interest. I don't think that has a lot of weight because, I mean, ultimately, the people that are making the decisions are the people that have pretty much controlled, in terms of their ethnic origins and their religion and what have you, since the origins of this country, is white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And to the extent that Israel or Jewish voters or whatever are of use to them, they will consider their interest. The minute that it doesn't, they're toast. Which it could tip, for instance, just in terms of sheer numbers, either in this country for Muslim voters, could easily and quickly outnumber Jewish voters. And in the Middle East, the importance of Muslim countries, I mean, it's almost at that point now, and there's always been arguments within the State Department of where the United States should be tilting. The United States has always tried to have have it both ways. So we give billions of dollars to Israel, which is money down the drain, and billions of dollars to Egypt, which is equally money down the drain. They're playing with other people's money, ours. So to the extent that any U.S. policy or any person within the government acts out the foreign policy of Israel or whatever, if it even does, I think is way beside the point. I mean, the policymakers have agendas that go way beyond that. I mean, that could be a small little side note of it. But most of it is political imperial control of the world to the benefit of U.S. Corporations and political control within the United States. And as I say, to the extent that this coincides with what they want, well, they'll make deals with anybody. All right, thank you for bringing it up. Appreciate it. Here is JT and Wayne. JT, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete.
Hi.
I have so many things I want to talk about, but I'll limit it to four, time and everything. First, while I was on hold, all I heard was, I think, Ghazi.
We still haven't figured out how to get the show on hold, so Jay Hudson, our producer, is playing some music for you.
Well, I appreciate that instead of just nothing.
Right.
But I'm trying to keep up with you.
Yeah, the other thing to do, and this is very important, though, is to you could listen on the radio, then as soon as I come on, turn it down.
Well, that's what I did.
Yeah, good.
Now, a couple other things. First, you asked, what is the war in Iraq worth it? Only to Bush.
Yeah.
Only to Bush. I mean, to me, it's not worth it. To you, it's not worth it. To America, it's not worth it. I mean, the schools, Social Security, everything is just decaying as we speak. Because billions of dollars are going over there for what? Just so blood can be shed for oil.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oil,
Well, right now, let me see here. Although I don't think this is the best way to put it, but I thank Thomas from Ann Arbor, who wrote into Call Talk Yes at yahoo.com. Let me just read this quickly, and I'll get back to your call. It's a quick note. Cost of the war so far, with a total cost so far of $162 billion and a population of 280 million, that means we have a cost of $580 per person so far. Which means if we have a family of four, it's over $1,000. But that's not a really, you figure $1,000, number. But that's not, for the average working family of four, we have a total of, $2,320. Now compare this to the $300 to $600 tax rebates that so many of the conservative callers have praised previously on your show. But, that's all correct. But really what you got to see this as driving us further into debt. I mean, as it is. I mean, there's editorials that, like in the New York Times, that represents big money interests, that they're concerned that the economy is teetering. We had, now here, for you conspiracy people, last month the government reported that the United States deficit in international transactions, mainly trade, reached an unprecedented $666 billion. Ooh. Wait a minute, I got my caller here. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, that's a hell of a coincidence, the 666.
Yeah.
Also I want to touch on 9/11 real quick.
Sure.
At the very best, Bush let 9/11 happen. The White House, the Bush regime, let it happen. At worst, they made it happen. I mean, there's a, in 1997 or 98, Dick Cheney wrote that thing that said they wanted like a Pearl Harbor event to happen. And come on, we all know if Bush and the Bin Ladens are buddies, come on. And it just takes a little imagination to say Bush made it happen. And
well,
that makes Bush the biggest war criminal in U.S. history.
I mean, I don't have any trouble with you saying it. I mean, I think that it could be a stretch, and I think it's kind of that the whole incident. I mean, either that you have. I mean, I don't know how else you can look at it. And these, as far as I'm concerned, September 11th was grounds for impeachment. Exactly what would have occurred to Al Gore if he would have rightfully assumed the presidency since he won in 2000. And if he would have been so remiss in allowing this catastrophic intelligence failure, which would have been misfeasance, that would, in other words, that you screwed up. But what you're charging is essentially malfeasance, an intention to do something bad. But either way you cut it, impeachment was certainly in order. All right, thank you very much. We'll be right back.
If you think it's too late in life to earn the college degree you want, listen to this. Now you can go to a college designed for busy working adults. It's University of Phoenix, the nation's largest private accredited university. In most cases, you can earn a bachelor's or master's degree in just 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classroom settings are designed for working adults with busy lives. With their efficient learning model, you'll cover more material in less time, going to convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. For a complimentary brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more, call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Classes are forming, so call now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Anglers, get ready to cast your line for a big money this year because the WRAF Fishing Championship Series is coming. The series consists of 4 tournaments this year: walleye, catfish, bass, and muskie. In each tournament, anglers compete for cash and prizes, and the team with the best average finish in the 4 tournament series will also win $1,500 cash, plus the title of 2005 WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champions. After each event, competitors get to kick back and party at Big Al's Sports Bar for the awards and more chances to win prizes from the Riff. The first tournament kicks off on April 23rd at the Lake Erie Metro Park for the WRAF Walleye Championship. The teams start their boats at 6:30 a.m. and will weigh their catch at 4 p.m. 2 to 3 person teams compete for thousands in cash and prizes, but one team will finish the day holding the championship trophy. To sign up or to find out about a sponsorship, call 248-591-6841 today or go to WRIF.com to get a registration form. Become the WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today.
WRIF.com.
Take to the ice with 101 WRIF and Labatt Blues 21 and over Summer Hockey Challenge. Games run in June at rinks across Detroit with a 3-game guarantee. All skill levels are welcome. More info available at WRIF.com or call Suburban Training Center at 248-888-1400. Get hockey with Labatt Blue and 101 WRIF.
Rip rocks.
A night of black leather, hot bands, great food, wicked bikes, and more. Plus, you can bid on a 2005 Harley-Davidson Fatboy. The 6th annual MD8 Black and Blue Ball. May 6th at the Ritz-Carlton in Dearborn. Call for tickets at 586-274-9000. From Ford Motor Company, Motor City Harley-Davidson, Pepsi Bottling Group, and 101 WRIF.
Detroit's rock station, 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like the Shark Club on Ford Road, just east of Canton Center Road in Canton. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price. But quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
On the rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Riff rocks.
Yeah, that just turned out to be a lot easier.
Red Robin.
Yum.
Visit Red Robin Gourmet Burgers and Spirits in Clinton Township or Roseville.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. And we do this show, this part of it at least, till 1 a.m. Eastern time. And then we'll be doing a couple of interviews. Let me see here. Yeah, this is, wait a minute, I think it's a different name is on here. Yeah, Clayton writes in, longtime listener since 1984. Wow. Wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, I recall you interviewing members of an international election voting organization that brought in election observers to key states in the United States to help oversee and investigate problems in our 2004 presidential elections. He says, I don't recall any follow-up post-election interview to have them comment on what they found. What happened? Essentially saying, I can't remember. And I think, you know what, if my memory serves me right, Clayton, you can go to globalexchange.org, globalexchange.org, and that's the people that put this together. I mean, the elections in the U.S. have gotten so suspicious that we actually had international observers here. And we used to send, I guess we still do, observers. Now we're getting them sent here. And that drove something totally out of my brain. Let me see. What did I think here? I don't know. I guess, as my mother used to say, if it was important, you will remember it. All right. Here is Mike and Fraser. Mike, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Or I said correctly, Fraser. Right.
Well, I don't know. I think might be Fraser, but there's no I there.
No, I know. But everybody from Fraser says Fraser, don't they?
Yeah, they do. But I sort of take issue with it. But anyway.
That's like that street Lazar that everybody calls Lasher.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it like that street, how would it be? Gradio or something? Not Gratiot.
Gradiot?
Yeah. All right. Go ahead. People in other cities probably don't know what the hell we're talking about, but go ahead.
They don't know we have too many French names around here.
Instead of Livernois, we say Livernoise.
I always thought it might be Cadieux instead of Cadieux.
And, okay, what about Freud Street instead of Freud and Goethe instead of Goethe?
Goethe, yeah.
All right, go ahead.
Pete, you mentioned it a couple times tonight, and I just read an article. It was online in RollingStone.com, written by a guy named, I think his name is Howard Kunstler.
Yeah?
And the title of this thing was called The Long Emergency. And the upshot is that we've reached peak global oil production right about now. And that everything, so we've gotten all the low-hanging fruit out of the ground, so to speak, to mix metaphors. And man, it's going to be a rough ride after this. And we ain't never going to see a buck a gallon. Or two even. We won't see anything under $2 a gallon for the near term. And I think, I guess, going forward, I think people who are driving around in these things like Ford Extinctions and, you know, these other monsters, that it's going to be $5 a gallon.
Well, you know? That's the way it is in Europe now, $5 and $6 a gallon. They're just used to it. But, you know, I remember I said to a working-class guy from London one time, I said, do you get up to Scotland much? And he, which is about maybe, I think, about 300, 350 miles. And he said, Scotland? No. I mean, you know, whereas we say, hey, it's Friday. It's Friday at 4. Let's drive up to Traverse City, right?
Exactly. Well, the kind of the upshot of this article is that things that Americans take for granted, like you said, this long-distance travel, getting goods from all over the world, that's all going to be gone if the oil economy crashes, which is what's going to happen if we don't do something now. And it's kind of a grim, you know, some of it, I guess, you might call science fiction or, you know, it's speculation, but I think the guy hits on a lot of things, which is, you know, like you were talking earlier about oil war. There's going to be oil war. There's going to be disruptions in supply lines all over the world. It's really kind of a horrible, you know, scenario.
Well, it is. And here's another part of the scenario as well, is that one of the ways you cut consumption is to cut income to large sections of the Western population, beginning with what's happening now. It's sort of the race to the bottom at the United States. So we begin to have a structure like Guatemala, where you have maybe a third of the country that's well-waged and capable of consumption and can afford cars that get 17, 18, 19 miles a gallon. And the other two-thirds eventually, maybe even within our lifetimes, you know, wind up riding the bicycles that Rich from Boulder is always talking about. And they live in a sub-economy where the consumption level is extraordinarily low. So people say, well, yeah, hey, if we lay off all these people and we get rid of all these union jobs, how are we going to have enough Americans to consume? Well, we won't. But since all trade has virtually become global, what's going to occur is that markets will be international, and that's what we'll have. We'll have this sort of top tier that is, you know, well-waged and lives real good and lives in the standards we take for granted for a middle-class American life, and the bulk of the peasantry will have to just be much, much lower on the food chain.
Well, this guy even addresses that sort of thing, saying that most people in, you know, the middle class is going to be devastated by this, and that we're going to have to return to some form. You know, if they don't do anything, if we as a people don't do anything about, you know, sustainability, I guess, we're going to have to, it'll be forced on us, and we're going to have people that, you know, will be landless serfs or, you know, basically, you know, sharecropping farm. Right? We're going to have to return to an agrarian type of society. I mean, it was sort of, you know, it sounds like science fiction, but, you know, it's not that far-fetched if you just sort of take it to its logical conclusion.
Well, I don't know how much you've spent inside of Detroit, but it's almost ready for farming again. There's hundreds and hundreds of acres without houses on them. Well, and this is happening apace. I mean, we hear this every day. I was looking at the front page of the Detroit News and the Free Press. Big Three scales back benefits. Cradle-to-grave perks are casually rising costs and stiff competition. And just talking about how all these benefits from both union and white-collar workers are going down the drain. Next story, Sears to cut 500 workers at its Illinois headquarters, and just on and on and on. In the meantime, so all that's going on. I mean, we hear about these massive layoffs all the time. There's an article from last week's New York Times, Sunday Times, My Big Fat CEO Paycheck, and talking about how of these 179 largest companies, the average pay for the CEOs was $10 million apiece. So the upper tier is rewarded highly. The vast lower tier is getting the rug pulled out from under us.
You mentioned the agrarian thing with Detroit. Detroit actually is mentioned in this article.
Really?
Talking about this unsustainability of the large cities. And cities like Detroit, Cleveland, St. Louis are already experiencing the sort of collapse. And they talk about a lot of things, you know, urban sprawl and mass transit, you know, that, you know, just going across the country. You were talking about the Scotland thing. I mean, just a grim scenario, and I don't think people driving around in their big SUVs and stuff, you know, they think that's a way of life, and that's just going to vanish. I mean, this is the beginning. The war in Iraq is going to be, in historical terms, the beginning of the end.
It could be. I'd like to suggest an article. I mean, it's quite long, but quite revealing, and it's called Planet of Slums. And it's written by a man named Mike Davis, who also a book he's written, a collection of essays called Dead Cities. I mean, this is not pleasant stuff, folks. And someone said, God, Pete, you are so grim. Don't you ever have any fun? And I was thinking, if people define the totality of my personality by what they heard on this show, they must think, geez, he never thinks about anything pleasant. Well, you know, I mean, I guess I have enough luxury in my life, being a middle-class American that still is able to maintain that standard of living, that I actually do have lots of periods of enjoyment, a lot of things I do that are fun. On the other hand, we're under the sword of Damocles, and just, you know, absolutely in the manner that Mike is talking about. And I think it'd be good to know this stuff so that the rug all of a sudden doesn't get pulled out from under us collectively, and we haven't a clue. But, Mike, I should move on.
All right. Hey, good night, Pete.
Thank you for calling in.
All right. Bye.
Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Here's a caller whose name I don't have up. Who's this? Hello?
Hello?
Hello, who's this?
Hi, this is Vicky.
Vicky, hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Honey, you made a comment about pharmaceutical meds and lethal meds.
Uh-huh.
I was diagnosed with Crohn's about 18 months ago.
Oh, boy.
And I'm very highly symptomatic, disabled symptomatic.
Boy, that's terrible.
And they treated me with lethal meds for, 16 months with severe side effects. So I just wanted to let you know that if somebody out there agrees, and they have this new drug, Remicade. I don't know if you've heard of it.
No.
It's a IV injection.
Okay.
And it's supposed to get rid of the symptoms. And that do you know what Crohn's is?
Sure, I do.
Okay. So
it's a digestive tract, lower digestive tract disease, yeah.
Right, and it's a very serious and it's a very painful. It affects everything. Well, this Remicade that everybody is, it's like the newest out and it's supposed to be the miracle drug for Crohn's patients. Well, the side effect is blood disorders.
Oh, boy.
Which you get a blood disorder, basically you're dead. I lost my dad to a blood disorder. So finally he treated me with all these lethal meds, and I went through 18 months of couch. I was on the couch in pain from all these side effects of these meds, and I ended up having a 5.5-hour surgery.
I mean, that's terrible. I mean, but you know, one of the things I would suggest if you have not already done this, sometimes by the luck of the draw, we find a physician that really is in touch with what's going on in our lives, and other times we don't. But there's a lot of people now that have grouped together with similar illnesses online. And if you haven't already done that, I would look for a group online. And because generally, because you're reinventing the wheel, of course, in terms of trying to deal with this problem you're confronting, where you'll find in these groups that people have already gone through the awful experience you have. And plus, you have something to tell other people.
Right. I joined the biggest group. I joined the CCFA, which is the Crohn's Colitis Foundation of America.
Well, I don't know. I sometimes run public service announcements for them, so I'm sure they're fine. But I'm saying that the groups of patients that have groups online where they talk to one another and what have you.
Right. So just find a site.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I think if you went to Google and just put Crohn's group. I got a feeling probably 20 would pop up.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah. Well, check it out. Let me know. If you get a chance, email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
I sure will, and I want to thank you for a great show. I'm a new listener, and thank my fiancé, Pete, because he's the one that said, Vicky, you got to hear him. He's awesome.
All right. Well, thank you, Vicky, and good health to you, okay?
Thanks. Have a good night.
All right. Bye-bye. Oh, boy. The human body, what it does to us sometimes, huh? Here's Kevin in Romulus. Kevin, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Great show as usual. And
thank you.
I just wanted to know what your opinion was with all this dumb stuff going down in Arizona with all these right-wing militia types organizing the Minutemen thing and general hostility towards immigrants these days. And,
well, it's too bad in a way that it's come from the right. In fact, I had some stuff up on my website about it, but took it off. They said they were going to have 1,000 vigilantes, and they wound up just a little over 100. And it was sort of these militia types. And, we used to talk, and still do in terms of Cuba, as refugees from communism. And the Mexicans and people that are even coming from farther south are essentially refugees from capitalism. Capitalism that doesn't work. Ones that have been thrust into the lowest rung of the international economy. And, of course, the millions of illegal workers in this country provide, one thing, they subsidize Social Security. They're not going to get anything for it. But FICA tax is taken out of their wages very frequently, and they they wind up a pool of cheap labor, which is works to often to the benefit of some of the people hiring, not often to the people that are competitive workers. But it's one of these things, like the immigrants crossing the border illegally is a symptom of these great problems that have not been addressed in the hemisphere. And what these guys are doing is just obviously not working at all. And, of course, completely without any compassion, which is typical of the right wing. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let me see here. What do I have time? I got time for just this one last call here, so the other two are not going to make it. Let me get Lynn on from Detroit. Lynn, hi, it's Peter Werby.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Doing good.
All right, here, I want to get to the point. Right now, I'm going to be leaving to go to Washington, D.C. tomorrow about the schools. You know, you always talk about the schools and how bad the condition they're in.
Yeah.
So I actually walked. I'm walking 200 miles to D.C. I've completed my miles today. Drove back from Indiana out of Ohio, and I'm going to be going to D.C. to meet with some congressmen to talk about what can they do to, you know, to help the city of Detroit, to help the Detroit metropolitan area schools. And I thought you might want to know about something like that, since I took it upon myself to just get out there and walk.
Yeah, no, that's great. It's great that you're doing that. You know, one of the things that they're going to tell you, though, is they're going to say there's no money. And for once, there'll be some politicians telling you the truth. And because if we give all these tax cuts to the wealthy, then, and this is the first time in the history of humanity that any country has ever given tax cuts during a war, and we've already frittered away $162 billion, they're going to say there's no money. And there's not. I mean, you know, people say, oh, it's Kwame's fault or something like that. I don't know. Maybe I don't live in Detroit, so I don't know whether he's the best or the worst mayor, but it's...
they're closing schools all over the state.
Exactly.
They're closing all over the state. And I
exactly.
The federal government needs to know. So I'm wearing a shirt that says Urban Education Crisis, you know, do something. And I'm actually going to be marching into D.C. tomorrow. And I emailed all 32 congressmen from the Congressional Black Caucus, and so far I haven't heard from any of them.
Well, a lot of times, you know, politicians just don't want to hear about it. Are you in Detroit right now?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay.
I came back home tonight to pack my clothes because I'm leaving tomorrow driving because I can only walk 200 miles. So I walked 200 miles out, and I left on – I started on Martin Luther King's anniversary. It was April 4th. I started walking from here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would walk 25, 30, 40 miles, come back home, you know, go back out where I started, start over again. So I've actually done 200 miles. I was out in Lima, Ohio, some part of Ohio out there in the farm fields. So tomorrow I'm going to get into D.C. tomorrow night.
Well, good work. Good for you. And sometimes it takes individuals or just little pieces of what we do before people finally figure it out. I mean, why in the wealthiest country in the world do we have to be fighting to get funding for our schools?
Well, public education. I mean, it's ridiculous. So I just wanted you to know that because I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller, and I just said, let me call him and let him know that as an individual I'm taking this civil action. So someone needs to know that everyone needs to know out there who's listening that, you know, educators are fed up. I'm an educator administrator myself. Frustrated at what they're saying, frustrated at what they're doing, closing schools, laying off people. And it's not anyone's here fault. It's partly the federal government's fault because of how they're frittling away our money.
Sure. Well, then, will you do this? Will you call back next week and let us know what happened on your trip?
Oh, sure. Sure, I will. I'll be sure to call you back, Peter. And thanks for taking my call. And to all the listeners, just know that some educators are dedicated and passionate for the kids. And we're doing all we can. But when the money's not there, like Peter says, the money's not there, we can't do a lot because we don't have the resources.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Peter.
All right, keep up the good work. It's necessary. All right, I thought we were going to talk about a lot about religion, and I promised I would play again George Carlin's Ten Commandments. You know, I mean, if it's offensive to you, my apologies in advance. But it's one man's opinion. You know, he's a rough, rough comedian. So I'll be right back after this, about 6 minutes.
Now, folks, here's something else I got a problem with. The Ten Commandments, you know? Yeah. Yeah, let me tell you. Listen, here's my problem. Why are there ten? You don't need ten. I think the list of commandments was deliberately and artificially inflated to get it up to ten. It's a padded list. Here's what they did. About 5,000 years ago, a bunch of religious and political hustlers got together to try to figure out how to control people, how to keep them in line. They knew people were basically stupid and would believe anything they were told, so they announced that God had given them some commandments. Up on the mountain, when no one was around, God had given them the Ten Commandments. But let me ask you this. When they were sitting around making this shit up, why did they pick 10? Why 10? Why not 9 or 11? I'll tell you why. Because 10 sounds official. 10 sounds important. They knew if it was 11, people wouldn't take it seriously. So what, are you kidding me? The 11 commandments? Get the fuck out of here. But 10. 10 sounds important. 10 is the basis for the decimal system. It's a decade. It's a psychologically satisfying number. The top 10, the 10 most wanted, the 10 best dressed. So having 10 commandments was really a marketing decision. And to me, it's clearly a bullshit list. It's a political document artificially inflated to sell better. I'm going to show you how you could reduce the number of commandments and come up with a list that's a little more workable and logical. We're going to start with the first three, and I'll use the Roman Catholic version because those are the ones I was taught as a little boy. I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not have strange gods before me. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Thou shalt keep holy the Sabbath. Right off the bat, the first three, pure bullshit. Sabbath day, Lord's name, strange gods. Spooky language. Spooky language. Designed to scare and control primitive people. In no way does superstitious nonsense like this apply to the lives of intelligent, civilized humans in the 21st century. If you throw out the first three commandments, you're down to 7. Next, honor thy father and mother. Obedience, respect for authority. Just another name for controlling people. The truth is, obedience and respect should not be automatic. They should be earned. They should be based on the parents' performance. Parents' performance. Right? Some parents deserve respect. Most of them don't. Period. You're down to 6. Now, in the interest of logic, something religion is very uncomfortable with, we're going to jump around the list a little bit. Thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness. Stealing and lying. Well, actually, these two both prohibit the same kind of behavior. Dishonesty, stealing, and lying. So you don't need two of them. Instead, you combine them and you call it thou shalt not be dishonest. And suddenly, you're down to 5. And as long as we're combining, I have 2 others that belong together. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. Once again, these two prohibit the same kind of behavior. In this case, marital infidelity. The difference is coveting takes place in the mind. And I don't think you should outlaw fantasizing about someone else's wife. Otherwise, what's a guy going to think about when he's waxing his carrot? But marital fidelity is a good idea, so we're going to keep the idea and call this one, thou shalt not be unfaithful. And suddenly, we're down to 4. But when you think about it, honesty and fidelity are really part of the same overall value. So in truth, you could combine the 2 honesty commandments with the 2 fidelity commandments and give them simpler language, positive language instead of negative, and call the whole thing, thou shalt always be honest and faithful, and we're down to 3. Thou shalt, they're going away fast. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods. This one is just plain f***ing stupid. Coveting your neighbor's goods is what keeps the economy going. All right? Your neighbor gets a vibrator that plays O Come All Ye Faithful. You want to get one too. Coveting creates jobs. Leave it alone. You throw out coveting and you're down to 2 now, the big honesty and fidelity commandment, and the one we haven't talked about yet, thou shalt not kill, murder, the 5th commandment. But when you think about it, religion has never really had a big problem with murder. Not really. More people have been killed in the name of God than for any other reason. All you have to do... Sure. All you have to do is look at Northern Ireland, the Middle East, Kashmir, the Inquisition, the Crusades, and the World Trade Center to see how seriously the religious folks take thou shalt not kill. The more devout they are, the more they see murder as being negotiable. It's negotiable. You know? It depends. It depends on who's doing the killing and who's getting killed. So, with all of this in mind, I leave you with my revised list of the two commandments. Thou shalt always be honest and faithful to the provider of thy nookie. And thou shalt try real hard not to kill anyone. Unless, of course, they pray to a different invisible man from the one you pray to. Two is all you need. Moses could have carried him down the hill in his f***ing pocket. And if they had a list like that, I wouldn't mind those folks in Alabama putting it up on the courthouse wall. As long as they included one additional commandment, thou shalt keep thy religion to thyself. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for coming in. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.
That's George Carlin on WRF in Detroit. Peter Werby here with you. Kind of our final little note of this section of Night Call. And we'll talk again live next week. Right now, we're going to just play a few little commercials and then be right back with a couple of, I think, interesting interviews. Thanks for listening.
Catch your line for a big money this year because the WRAF Fishing Championship Series is coming. The series consists of four tournaments this year: walleye, catfish, bass, and muskie. In each tournament, anglers compete for cash and prizes, and the team with the best average finish in the four tournament series will also win $1,500 cash, plus the title of 2005 WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champions. After each event, competitors get to kick back and party at Big Al Sports Bar for the awards and more chances to win prizes from the RIF. The first tournament kicks off on April 23rd at the Lake Erie Metro Park for the WRAF Walleye Championship. The teams start their boats at 6:30 a.m. and will weigh their catch at 4 p.m. Two- to three-person teams compete for thousands in cash and prizes, but one team will finish the day holding the championship trophy. To sign up or to find out about a sponsorship, call 248-591-6841 today or go to WRIF.com to get a registration form. Become the WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
Hockey season may be on ice, but Miller's VIP concert series is still heating up. Miller Lite wants you to see why Detroit still rocks. Big bands, small venues, and great beer. Get a taste of what hockey season is missing. It's VIP show number 4 with Shinedown, 3 days Grace and Cedar, coming to the Masonic Temple, downtown Detroit. Keep it locked on 101 WRIF for more details on how to win your VIP tickets. From Miller Lite, there's good enough, then there's better than it has to be. Miller. Good call. This is WRIF.com.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Shields, ideal for business lunches and family dinners, with locations in Southfield, Troy, Dearborn, Commerce Township, and their newest location in Warren. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
On the rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF.
Riff rocks.
Like when you
here on the Riff, then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rocks.
A night of black leather, hot bands, great food, wicked bikes, and more. Plus, you can bid on a 2005 Harley-Davidson Fat Boy.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. I'm a big fan of the movies, big fan of novels as well. We don't do many novels on this show because, this is about political issues, social issues, cultural issues. Although novels always reflect the era in which they are set. And a very, very interesting era is of film and of literature is the noir era, N-O-I-R, French for black. And you've probably heard the phrase, film noir. It's those films of the late 40s and into the 50s. Things like The Postman Always Rings Twice, Murder, My Sweet, any number of the detective films. Some of the Chandler films that were made into movies and what have you. Joining me is a Detroit area resident, at least formerly from our area. Her name is Megan Abbott, and she has taught literature, writing, and film at New York University and the State University of New York at Oswego. And she is the author of a nonfiction study called The Street Was Mine, White Masculinity in Hard-Boiled Fiction and Film Noir. You know, all of a sudden with that title, you can kind of picture those films, right? And she has brought out a novel. The novel is called Die a Little, a novel by Megan Abbott. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Welcome home, Megan Abbott.
Thanks for having me.
And where are you from in the Detroit area?
I was born in Warren, and I grew up primarily in Grosse Pointe. My father teaches at Wayne State in Detroit.
Really?
Yes. He teaches political theory, actually.
What's his first name?
Philip.
Philip Abbott. That sure sounds familiar. Here, we're chatting rather than doing a show. Now, connect your book, The Street Was Mine, White Masculinity in Hard-Boiled Fiction and Film Noir, and suddenly you come out with a hard-boiled fiction, Die a Little. What's the connection between the two?
I'd like to say that they're directly connected, but I think it's a little more complicated than that. I was drawn to The Street Was Mine, the nonfiction study, comes from my graduate work at NYU. I was studying detective novels and crime novels. I was studying them because I loved film noir. I'd sort of grown up with it. So I came to study it through a love of it, and I came to write the novel also for a love for it. So it wasn't until after I wrote the novel that I could kind of step outside of it and analyze it from the point of view of someone, you know, looking at these from an analytical distance. But after I finished the novel, I was able to kind of see what the connection might be from what I found in the nonfiction study and to what I actually produced, which I guess would be basically all hard-boiled novels, tough guy fiction, et cetera, they tend to have a similar kind of narrator. It's often the hard-boiled detective, the cynical tough guy, or in the case of the novels of James Cain, you had mentioned Postman Always Rings Twice, they're these kind of wanderers or drifters drifting into some kind of crime, but they very rarely have any female characters aside from the femme fatale, that lethal, gorgeous woman who lures the central character possibly to his doom. So I wanted to write a novel from another kind of female perspective. And so I have a narrator, a first-person narrator, who instead of the detective is this sort of middle-class, suburban woman. She's a school teacher. She lives with her brother, someone that you really wouldn't see in hard-boiled fiction or film noir. And I wanted to make her the investigator at the heart of the novel. I do have a femme fatale sort of figure in the novel, but the other change, I guess, is that I tried to make her perhaps more realistic with a little more she's viewed instead of through the view of someone who desires her, she's viewed by another woman. So I thought it might be interesting to see her. You know, in the novels, the femme fatale is often animalized or exoticized or made to seem somehow unreal in her power. And so I wanted to do a picture of her that was a little more realistic and down to earth and see what would happen.
Often evil as well.
Yes, often evil. And almost to the point, if you think of Double Indemnity and Barbara Stanwyck in that movie, her lethality is, it seems virtually psychotic, and almost mechanical. Like she will do anything to get what she wants. So I wanted to do something that was a little different from that for the novel.
Mm-hmm. Well, put it, I mentioned cultural and social political context of a given era. So late 40s and early 50s, we were looking at this triumphal period. The United States had just won World War II, and everything, it was the Pax Americana, peace throughout the world under the aegis of the American Empire. At home, it was a little early for that, but sort of Ozzie and Harriet-ish.
Mm-hmm.
But then there is this dark, noir side that comes out in these novels. What's the context that suddenly these would bubble up from the underground?
Right. That's actually something I talk about a lot in my nonfiction study because I think it's really interesting. A lot of arguments consider the tough guy rather reactionary figure as this kind of racist, misogynist, homophobic guy who's really sort of an oppressive force. But actually, I see it very differently. I mean, there are those elements to the novels, but I see him as this rather renegade figure during the Cold War, especially because the model of white masculinity in the Cold War is just as you're saying, it's a suburban father, husband, head of household, company man in a gray flannel suit who votes, who is a patriot, who is sort of at the forefront of this sort of rise of America. And of course, the tough guy doesn't fit in any of those categories. He's almost never married. He's a loner. He moves between classes. He moves among different races. And he's, you know, he doesn't have children. He's much more of an outlaw, outsider figure, more like the Western hero or the pioneer than the sort of icon of the era. So I see it much like the films as the American public working out in many ways their reaction against this other oppressive, culturally perceived Cold War model. You know, this is the nitty gritty aspect of American culture at the time, because of course these books were huge bestsellers, widely read, especially the Mickey Spillane one.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. This is the time when the paperback industry really takes off. So the first time you have a much wider readership. You didn't have to have a lot of money to buy books. So you have a different audience. You have a lot of working class readers of these novels. So in many ways, we can see it as reflecting a kind of discontentment with the status quo, with the norm of the period.
Mm-hmm. Well, Megan Abbott, in your novel, Die a Little, there is a different sense. In other words, as you indicated, usually the hard-boiled detective, the Mike Hammers, if you will, or Sam Spades or whoever, whenever I read those, and some of those go back into the 20s, I always thought, who are these guys? Did they just get dropped on the planet? I mean, where was their family? Did they come from Kansas and just wind up in San Francisco or New York or Chicago? And they always, they're flippant. Some of them have this just level of rage like Mike Hammer.
Right.
That's continuous. But in your novel, Die a Little, there are. There's families. There's connectedness. So there is a difference there.
Right, yes. And in fact, you do get the other genre that kind of seeps into my novel is the suburban or domestic melodrama that was big in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking of things like All That Heaven Allows or Magnificent Obsession. And I've sort of crashed those two worlds together here. So you do have this view of 50s suburbia. And the way I sort of visioned it is that the character who is part of that world is kind of peeling back that artificial layer and finding what's beneath it and finding this gritty version of Los Angeles, the novel set in suburban Los Angeles, but the main character moves into the sort of mean streets, if you will, of Los Angeles and leaves behind that that sort of artificial suburban world. Not that the hard-boiled world doesn't have its level of artifice, of course, because as you're saying, these are people without backgrounds who talk in this very stylized vernacular. And, Raymond Chandler was famous for his lines, that Philip Marlowe would say, like, she was a blonde to make a bishop kick through a plate, stained glass window, that kind of stuff.
That's good.
He was, very hyperbolic. But the idea was that these are the two predominant cultural narratives of the time in literature and film, the woman's picture, of the period, and then these dark noir films. So I kind of wanted to knock the two together and see what would happen.
What does Megan Abbott, the author, think of these films? You say, I mean, you most of these were not written or or filmed before you were born. They were all written. Yet you say you grew up with them. I mean, it wasn't like you were going to the movie theater or those were the hot bestsellers at the time. I mean, you had to make a special effort to look at this genre. What was the attraction? I mean, for one thing, on the face of them, they seem, you know, wildly misogynist. And,
and
women are relegated to the worst roles. I mean, Mike Hammer shoots in cold blood a woman at a famous ending of one of his stories all that. And so it would seem to have the you would think that these would be the kind of things that would repel a modern woman.
Right, yes. And you know, Spillane is the one you could always go to for the most egregious examples, definitely, because he was, his character, you know, the Philip Marlowe, the Raymond Chandler character, he's a kind of this tarnished knight figure. He has sort of a code of honor. But the far more popular, of course, was Spillane's Mike Hammer as this kind of avenging force. I guess I came to it, I was always an old movie fan, and when I was a kid in Detroit, Channel 50 would show old movies on the weekends, and I loved the stars, and I loved Humphrey Bogart, and so it just became this gradual process that I eventually went to these source novels. And what I found in them was that they're more complicated than they appear. You know, for every Spillane, there's a Chandler or a Hammett that betray these much more complicated views of gender, of race. These are characters who are very frightened by the changes of modern society. You know, dissolving gender role, changing gender roles, women entering the workforce in the 40s, et cetera. They're very disturbed by it in many ways, but they're also strangely fascinated by it, and I think that's why with the femme fatale figure, they're both horrified and very desirous of her. You know, so it shows the sort of twin appeal. So I think, you know, the more I dug into it, the more complicated it seemed and the more interested I became.
Mm-hmm. Megan Abbott, did you, this is kind of an odd question, but did you always sort of have a novel in you? I mean, I think I've written tens of thousands of words of articles and some analytic stuff and all that. There's not a single novel lurking inside of me at all. I mean, I can't imagine constructing a story and characters and what have you. Did this just kind of, Thomas Edison said that creation is what, 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration?
Exactly.
Did this write itself or was it?
I wish that it did, but it's funny. It did start in many ways that way because as I was finishing the end of my graduate work and writing the nonfiction book, it was kind of a release from that theoretical, stuff that, almost prevents you from enjoying things after a certain extent. You know, you're so used to analyzing the films, you can't enjoy them anymore. So it was kind of a side thing. And then it just sort of became all-consuming. You know, once I had found this narrator's voice, this, very unusual character for noir, once I found her voice, it became kind of relentless and I couldn't let it go. So, I wasn't expecting it. I really wasn't planning on writing a novel. But it just kind of seeped in somehow.
Well, is there any of it, and let me explain this, sort of Megan's revenge, in other words, sort of just flipping sort of the narrative has
right.
that. Is there, and then it, in a sense it becomes sort of self-conscious because we know it's the reverse of literature, detective literature written, say, 40 to 60 years ago.
Yes. I would say that it's not really, if it were, revenge suggests that I don't love these books, but I really do. But I would say it's a kind of wanting to enter that world and bring a new voice to it. And what was interesting, too, is I found that, though I had given this, middle-class school teacher as the narrator and was trying to make more realistic femme fatale, et cetera, it almost just fell into the same pattern anyway. She does really feel both attracted to and repelled by the femme fatale, and she does, much like the tough guy, the tough guy always has to either kill or send to prison or do something with the femme fatale at the end. Well, so does the narrator of this novel, so it's almost a lethal trap. The genre itself is a femme fatale, and you can't help but sort of get sucked into that kind of logic. Anything that is frightening must be contained. So the femme fatale in my novel, too, in many ways is. So I guess I could be accused of some of the same charges that are leveled against the tough guy novel.
Hmm. My guest, Megan Abbott, she's published the Simon & Schuster novel, Die a Little, and it's in the style, am I correct, of the noir detective hard-boiled fiction of the era that it's set in, the 50s in this case. Tell us a little about the cover, which suggests the sort of, I don't know if it suggests repressed sexuality, because it's actually kind of overt, but we were in an era where it was, you know, the films were still shot with the man and woman, even though they were married, in twin beds. And yet there was this heavy sexual overtone at that time. How does that play out in Die a Little?
It very much became part of it. And usually the tough guy in these novels has some kind of guilt or especially in the James Cain, where the narrators are often criminals or become criminals, they have some kind of, what at the time what could be considered a perversion or something along those lines that, you know, something they can't control, often sexually, whether it's desire for the femme fatale or something, or in the case of Mickey Spillane's Hammer, this basically psychotic rage, you know, that he can't contain. So in this novel, you know, you have a very upright narrator. So, you know, the question is, how is that going to play out? And of course, it plays out in that she suffers from a lot of sexual guilt from the repression of the era. You know, she has desires as any person, as any woman, but she feels very guilty about it. And part of her problem with her sister-in-law, the femme fatale of the novel, is that her sister-in-law doesn't have any problem expressing her sexual desires. And so that, in many ways, her desire to contain her sister-in-law is really just a projection of her own guilt, that, you know, that this woman can act on her desires, but the narrator feels ashamed of her desires. So it's sort of, again, that clashing of the melodrama with the noir, and that what is repressed in suburbia comes out in the streets of Los Angeles, I guess, if you will.
Well, talk to us a little, too, about the art itself, because I know when I was a kid and I'd look at these covers, and what they did to my little brain, what they were designed to do.
Yeah.
Now, of course, what the painting on the cover, which I would wish you would describe, is pretty tame, and certainly that just everything and imaginable is in fiction and films and what have you, but wasn't so in those. So I wonder if you could talk about the content of the painting on the cover and also the sexual content of the books and movies themselves.
Right. Well, I guess the cover, in the foreground, you have this blonde woman who represents the narrator, Laura, the school teacher, and she's looking off in one direction, and what we see behind her in the background is a man and a woman embracing, and the man is kissing the woman's neck, and the woman is looking basically both at Laura, the narrator in the foreground, and at us. The person, you know, looking at the book.
And her strap, I should say, even though this is a family show, her strap is falling. She has a very low-cut dress to begin with, and her strap is falling down. So it's very, very suggestive.
She's inviting us. She's tempting us in. And what was interesting, sort of behind-the-scenes story about this, is that the designer at Simon & Schuster, who painted this, actually painted it from a photograph. He and a photographer, and from what I understand, the photographer's wife, went to this seedy motel in New Jersey, and they staged a series of, you know, I guess there were about 100 of pulp shots, you know, that would sort of exemplify the novel. And then he did the painting from it. But I thought it was a great story unto itself, that they're trying to sort of enter into that time period and the kind of, you know, sexy feel of it, and the sort of the darkness of it, and they thought that if they did that, they could really capture it. It sounded like a great time. I wish I'd been there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was thinking, too, the content. Of course, the content is never explicit in terms of describing sexual activity, but it certainly is suggestive. I was even thinking in some of the movies. I can't remember the Bogart movie where he goes into a bookstore.
Oh yes, The Big Sleep.
The Big Sleep.
Yep.
And I mean that's pretty clear what went on between the shelves during the rainstorm there. Yet we're supposed to be in an era of great sexual repression.
Right. Exactly. I mean, there's Martin Scorsese, the director, talks a lot about noir. He has a book about, you know, American cinema, and especially B-movie noirs, you know, the really kind of low-budget versions of this. And he talks about the directors, and this is a lot of the big sort of classic noir directors like Samuel Fuller and people like that, as smugglers, and that they were finding ways to bring in more subversive themes or ideas or sexuality in these sort of subtle and discreet ways, be it certain camera angles or fade-outs or expressions, or a lot of times innuendo in the language, which you see in The Big Sleep as well with the Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. There's this great scene where I'm talking about horse racing, and it's a very loaded and has this sexual connotation. So in many ways you can think of this as just getting past the production code, just sort of finding ways mm-hmm. to walk that line and express what to these writers and directors I think was the real America. These things are going on, and just because we're at war or just because we're in Cold War doesn't mean we have to contain everything and project this perfect ideal, nuclear family, man, gray final suit, that kind of model.
Yeah, I mean, all you needed was the teeniest bit of imagination. I was thinking of Casablanca with Bogart and, I can't think of her name.
Ingrid Bergman. Yeah.
And that point where they meet up in his office, and then it fades out, and my wife said to me, "Do you think they made love?" And I said, "You have a question in your mind here." Wait, we were starting to run out of time here with Megan Abbott. Just a few minutes left. We're talking about her brand new novel, Die a Little, in the great tradition of noir film and novels. And this is set in Hollywood, and maybe nothing is better to contrast, the good with the underside of it all. And of course, usually these detectives find out that what was bad turns out to be even worse and more corrupt and more perverse the deeper they get into it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a standard characteristic of noir?
Definitely. And usually what happens at the end, and to a degree this happens in my novel too, because like I said, you can't get away from it, is that the detective, especially in the detective novels, finds himself infected by the end. It's kind of a Heart of Darkness narrative. In The Big Sleep, the novel, there's a lot of distaste and disgust over the rich, and the rich are Marlowe's clients, and at the end he helps them get away with their crime, so to speak, even though he's disgusted by it. And one of the last lines is he says to himself, "Me, I was part of the nastiness now," and he feels like it's a contagion, this sort of sickness out there, and that's very characteristic of the period. Even though Marlowe remains a kind of really kind of one of the most upstanding of these narrators, he too feels infected by how deep and how entrenched the sort of ugliness, the crime, etc. is. He feels tainted as well.
Mm-hmm. Megan Abbott, since you've taught literature, probably this is nothing new to you, but I read somewhere the thesis that the investigations into Hollywood and communist influence wasn't so much to stop communistic or socialistic attitudes, but rather was aimed at film noir, that the mm-hmm. idea that these politicians were saying, wait a minute, they're showing America and American culture and society to be terrible, right at the, that it's all fake at top. Have you heard that, and do you agree with it?
Yes, that's actually especially true of the novels. They were during the late 40s, during the real start of this Cold War containment policy. All these novels were pulled out of military libraries overseas, and there was actually a congressional investigation into both pulp novels, paperback fiction, and the magazines and comic books of the period. There's a lot of, you can look at the congressional testimony, there's a lot of harumphing and disgust expressed over the deviant sexualities that you find in these novels, and a lot focused just on the covers alone, and this desire to repress them. There was a real effort to contain this at that period, and I think in large part that's one of the reasons that you see the genre fade for a good number of years, and when it returns, it looks very different when you get something like Chinatown, or later when it becomes this really nostalgic view of the private eye, or a parody of the private eye. die. We see that a lot now, but much safer. You know, it never gets to that level of transgression again.
Yeah, we only have about 30 seconds left. I mean, now, usually in these modern detective novels, you actually see human sides of the detectives, and you know, he's got problems and what have you. Which do you like better, the modern guy or the old hard-boiled character?
That's a hard question. I do like, you know, for instance, to someone like James Ellroy, who has a much more baroque and rich, you know, sort of view of these detectives, for as an example, is wonderful. But to me, you can never beat the original. So I guess I'm old-fashioned at heart.
All right, thank you so much.
I keep going back to them. Thank you.
Megan
Thanks
Abbott,
for having me.
The book is Die a Little. It's published by Simon & Schuster. It's a novel. And again, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRIF.com. Hockey season may be on ice, but Miller's VIP concert series is still heating up. Miller Lite wants you to see why Detroit still rocks. Big bands, small venues, and great beer. Get a taste of what hockey season is missing. It's VIP show number 4 with Shinedown, 3 Days Grace, and Seether, coming to the Masonic Temple, downtown Detroit. Keep it locked on 101 WRIF for more details on how to win your VIP tickets. From Miller Lite, there's good enough, then there's better than it has to be. Miller. Good call. Anglers, get ready to cast your line for big money this year because the WRAF Fishing Championship Series is coming. The series consists of 4 tournaments this year: walleye, catfish, bass, and muskie. In each tournament, anglers compete for cash and prizes, and the team with the best average finish in the 4 tournament series will also win $1,500 cash, plus the title of 2005 WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champions. After each event, competitors get to kick back and party at Big Al Sports Bar for the awards and more chances to win prizes from the RIF. The first tournament kicks off on April 23rd at the Lake Erie Metro Park for the WRIF Walleye Championship. The teams start their boats at 6:30 a.m. and will weigh their catch at 4 p.m. 2 to 3 person teams compete for thousands in cash and prizes, but one team will finish the day holding the championship trophy. To sign up or to find out about a sponsorship, call 248-591-6841 today or go to WRIF.com to get a registration form. Become the WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
This is WRIF.com.
Detroit's rock station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Walker's Speakeasy, the West Side's hottest destination for great food, drinks, and daily entertainment, located on Beach Daily in Dearborn Heights. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings, like Buddy's Pizza. Come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock. Rocks.
Take to the ice with 101 WRIF and Labatt Blues 21 and over Summer Hockey Challenge. Games run in June at rigs across Detroit with a 3-game guarantee. All skill levels are welcome. More info available at WRIF.com or call Suburban Training Center at 248-888-1400. Get hockey with Labatt Blue and 101 WRIF.
Rip Rocks.
A night of black leather, hot bands, great food, wicked bikes, and more. Plus, you can bid on a 2005 Harley-Davidson Fat Boy. The 6th annual MDA Black and Blue Ball. May 6th at the Ritz-Carlton in Dearborn. Call for tickets at 586-274-9000. From Ford Motor Company, Motor City Harley-Davidson, Pepsi Bottling Group, and 101 WRIF.
No money down. If you go to rockfinancial.com and check out your options, you'll know a lot more. Most monthly payments for first-time homebuyers are less than rent payments. So if you go to rockfinancial.com, explore all your options, you'll find out. It's late night. It's a perfect time to go to rockfinancial.com.
Rock Financial is a Quicken Loans company and equal housing lender.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. You know, sometimes, as you listeners know, when I talk about economics, I call it the dismal science, because people hear economics, and I don't want to hear that. I want to hear about the latest scandal, the latest trial of a celebrity. I want to see photographs of a war, or at least buildings burning on the news. But you know what my opinion on that is, that you never really get to the root of what our own individual lives are about, what the life of our community and our world about. What's it all about, period? Those are big questions, and those big questions are answered in a series of books, at least addressed by Christopher Phillips. He's the author of the best-selling book, Socrates Cafe. His brand-new book out, Six Questions of Socrates, A Modern-Day Journey of Discovery Through World Philosophy. Now, on the face of it, and maybe I'm not giving you listeners enough credit, you go, oh, you know. But everybody actually involves themselves in these questions on a daily basis, whether they know it or not, about what's the nature of being? What's the nature of our fundamental definitions as human beings? What is reality? What is good? In fact, some of the six questions of Socrates that Christopher Phillips looks at in his book are the ones that Socrates himself raised. What is virtue? What is moderation? What is justice? What is courage? What is good? What is piety? Now, Christopher Phillips has traveled all around the world, Japan, here in Detroit, Mexico, Greece, and he's asked ordinary people to answer these questions and set up, or at least people have set up, a series of what they call Socrates Cafes to begin to address these questions. So with that long-winded introduction, it's a privilege to welcome Christopher Phillips. We reach him in Portland, Maine. Hi, Christopher Phillips. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Those are big questions. And, you know, actually, when you read through your book, you realize that people aren't avoiding them. They're willing to talk about them, aren't they?
They are. The problem has been that there's not many forums where they can get together and engage. You know, in this era of increasing complexity, where it's just so easy to stay behind a computer screen all day, I'm trying to get people back out, engaging one another, locking hearts and minds face to face. And that could be a rather revolutionary thing in this era, because I think that it's only when you engage thoughtfully with other reflective souls that you can come to a greater sense of who you are and who you can become. You know, group inquiry doesn't have to lead to groupthink. It can actually lead to greater autonomous thinking as you weigh and compare your own views and your own code against those of others.
Mm-hmm. You know, someone might say, with all these questions that you pose in your book, Six Questions of Socrates, with the answers to those and a dollar, you can get on the bus. I mean, in other words, questioning the validity of an inquiry of this sort. How does it have any practical bearing on someone who's getting up and going to work, raising kids, or trying to find a job, or whatever? Why are these questions, how do they rise to the level of importance?
Well, I think that even if tackling these questions doesn't lead you to make any dramatic career changes or relationship changes, it may simply broaden and deepen the lenses by which you look at your life. All of us have a philosophical code, whether we take the time to articulate it or not. And, you know, in the hurly-burly of everyday life, it's so easy not to take that blessed time to examine who you are. But I think by taking an hour a week and asking and sort of turning back on those that light within, that childlike but by no means childish questioning nature, it makes you more passionate about your mortal moment. It's so vital to have a sense of who you are and what life is all about. Otherwise, what separates us just from an automaton?
Mm-hmm.
It's so easy in everyday life to become very far removed from our most fundamental thoughts and our values. And I think that having a type of inquiry where you examine the six questions Socrates examined on the road to becoming a more excellent human being may well lead you to just be more thoughtful and reflective about the most everyday action in your life and how it may impact others for better or for worse. I think not only does it not give you a foundation of quicksand, but it can give you a much firmer foundation.
Well, I think we were both saying that there's an implicit examination of these questions all the time. And oftentimes, too, the stereotype of people doing philosophical investigation is either old men philosophers with long white beards, or like I did, sitting around the dormitories at Michigan State University saying, what is reality at 1:30 in the morning? But ultimately, that's kind of an important question, what is reality?
Well, you know, way back when, at its origins, at least its Western origins, and I suspect its origins all over the world, philosophy was the inquiry into everything over and under and through the sun that was of concerned you, that you were curious or perplexed about. Somehow it has devolved into this discipline where it's the inquiry into just a very narrow range of questions. And what's supposed to separate philosophy, and philosophy was the discipline from which all other disciplines sprang, it wasn't the questions asked, but the way you went about answering them. So I'm trying to recapture this method and resuscitate it, this method called the Socratic method. It's accessible to anyone. It's not easy. It's extremely rigorous, and at times it can be frustrating as much as it is exhilarating. But it's a method that enables us to gain a greater sense and appreciation that each and every person on this planet matters and counts. And instead of looking to some other guide or guru for the answers, we can look to ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, you, Christopher Phillips, in the first part of your book, Six Questions of Socrates, you begin with the examination of some of these questions at the very geographical spot that Socrates himself, the historic figure, actually asked these. Tell us both the Socratic method, but also, if you would, illustrate the process through which you involved yourself and others.
Well, the Socratic method is no more, no less than positing your view within a group of fellow inquirers, and then giving them a chance to examine it, to look at what speaks for and against it as you try to support your view and through very compelling evidence and cogent reasoning. Then, as they scrutinize it, they're also supposed to follow on by offering their unique philosophical code to whatever question it is, whether it's what is courage, what is excellence, or what is a good death, what is a bad life. So it's an evolving inquiry where one person follows on to what another has said as a springboard and platform for developing his or her own point of view. In my inquiries, I quite often just bring a dog-eared poster with me that says in many languages, "Welcome to Socrates Cafe," and I'll park myself in a place that I think is a great vortex or magnet for bringing people together. One of the places I went was the Agora, or marketplace in ancient Athens, where Socrates himself held court many, many moons ago. I did that not just for gimmicky reasons, but because this is where it all began. This was the plaza that wasn't just a marketplace for exchanging goods, but a place for exchanging ideas and ideals. It's the place from which my Greek ancestors lived. They eventually, in 1922, immigrated through Ellis Island to the United States. And
you went from a Greek name to Phillips.
Yes, their name was summarily changed in Ellis Island from Philippou to Phillips, and I'm thinking about summarily changing it back.
Why not?
Yeah, but the thing is, in most countries, there's places where people can gather, and there's actually a history of rather colorful people beginning a discourse and others gathering around quickly. And I have found in most parts of the world that people will very readily and eagerly gather with me and share their stories. In Athens, it was fascinating because it was rather spine-tingling to have a dialogue in the same place that Socrates himself held them. But it was also very telling, because where was I holding the dialogue? Well, amidst ruins. I was holding the dialogue in what had been the greatest civilization of all time, the cradle of democracy. And yet that great civilization had a peak, and then it had a precipitous and irreversible decline. And so it behooves us to try to understand why that happened. Those without even a cursory sense of history tend to think that things go on forever, but that's not true. And what usually leads to the greatest of the great civilizations having a decline that they're not able to arrest is not because of an outside aggressor or enemy, but from the crumbling within, from the utter failure of people to communicate. My concern in the United States right now is people of lots of different dispositions are so sure and certain of the rightness and righteousness of their own view that they don't even care to entertain perspectives that are diametrically different or dramatically different, when I would argue that the whole purpose of living is to open yourself up to very diverse ways of world viewing and world making. It's what makes life exhilarating.
My guest on the Peter Werby Show, Christopher Phillips, he's the author of Socrates Cafe and a brand new book called Six Questions of Socrates, A Modern-Day Journey of Discovery Through World Philosophy. And it also, and we'll talk about that in a little while, it tells you how to start your own Socrates Cafe. Christopher Phillips is going to be in our area Thursday, April 21st at Borders on Woodward in Birmingham. And the next day, Friday, April 22nd, in Ann Arbor at Shaman Drum, a wonderful bookstore, an independent bookstore, I may add, on South State Street, right kind of that, you know, area near the Michigan Theater. Well, I have to say, Christopher Phillips, and you said you saw my website at peterwerby.com. To some extent, I mean, I'm open and I like to talk with people. I do phone-in talk radio, and so I'm always engaged. But this doesn't sound good given what you're posing, but I do have this sense of assuredness of the basic correctness of my beliefs. But I like to have them challenged. I like to re-examine them. I like having questions posed to me that I can't answer, because then that makes me reevaluate it all. But I was wondering if all these questions that you pose about what is virtue and what is justice, what is moderation, and all of that, if I, as a sort of left-wing atheistic existentialist, if sitting in a room with a right-wing fundamentalist Christian, I mean, there's such a gulf there that I almost would say that that we would, not only when we come to different conclusions, we're starting from such a different set of premises. I would say that, to me, the dialogue is almost impossible.
I would say that it's the very reason that it would be so exhilarating is the very fact that you come at existence from such different foundations. I operate from the premise that everyone really wants that. Most human beings have much more in common than they have differently. Now, I have come to find in my travels and my dialogues with people who are fundamentalist Christians, who are fundamentalist Orthodox Muslims, that we have much more in common than we realize. I don't start out with this notion that we're going to be at loggerheads with one another. I think the problem is there's too often in dialogues we bring so much baggage with us from the outset and assume that we're going to just have this sort of knock-down, drag-out debate where there's this one-upsmanship and browbeating and interrupting, whereas I want to hear people's stories. I think everybody is naturally a storyteller, and the problem today is we're so concerned from the get-go about winning some sort of argument that we don't really just open ourselves up and carefully listen to what others have to say.
Well, that's certainly a sin of us talk show hosts. I would say that
sometimes
for sure.
Sometimes it's just simply not enough time, but yeah. I really think that it behooves us all to take courses in Listening 101 if we can, because there's an art and a craft to listening.
Well, Christopher Phillips, you've been all around the world, as I just interrupted you. Excuse me. And
very well, I might add.
Put that in terms of a story, because you've been all around the world. Make that real in terms of, like, somewhere where you remember where people that appeared to be at such loggerheads or coming from such different positions were able to have a successful Socratic dialogue.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I had a dialogue recently in the progressive Bay Area of California, and we talked about what is our right to privacy. And this very diminutive, soft-spoken man of Japanese ancestry, who I thought would be extremely liberal, I had some assumptions, started talking about the arsenal of weapons that he has in his home and how if anyone ever tried to approach his house that he didn't know, heaven knows what might happen. And many of the participants were rather aghast. We're just getting ready to go at them hammer and tongs. How dare you have such an arsenal in this time, and it's just the worst way to live. And I simply asked him, why? Well, it turns out that his parents had been interned during World War II, and they lived for years in an internment camp. They were American citizens, and yet they were taken against their will out of their home. His parents lived the rest of their lives, even when they were released, in deep fear and deep despair. And so his reaction has been to do this sort of to equip his home to defend himself. So again, I still find that very disagreeable. But the difference was I wanted to know his story. I wanted to know why he was coming from where he was coming from. And that was an epiphany to me. And I think it was to him, too, because no one had ever really cared to know why before he lived a certain way. Just that openness might create, over the long term, a greater sense of trust that, especially in a time when there once again is this worshiping at the idol of fear, where so many people are inured to think that there's a boogeyman under their bed, another one on the other side of the door, another one on the top of their roof. It's really important for us to, especially for different souls of different perspectives to gather. It's more vital than ever.
Do any of these Socrates cafes ever wind up in, I can't imagine that they wouldn't wind up in some interpersonal hostility or you go, oh, this is not what I intended.
Well, what amazes me, and I hold these in public places, and I never know who's coming, is in the thousands of dialogues I've held, I can count on one hand how few have devolved into some sort of knockdown, drag-out debate, because I model a type of listening where it becomes very apparent from the get-go that I really want to hear people's stories. I want them to support their stories with rational foundations, but I'm very curious to pick people's brains because it helps me further develop and amend and sometimes even overhaul my own code. It's especially been a blessing to go to culture so diametrically different from my own and to find out how people still in their own unique way, even though they have a very different value system, still are working for the same set of shared ends, such as working towards greater social harmony at the same time as they try to discover their most noble talents and to discover that becoming a more autonomous soul and developing a greater society of working towards a common good aren't contradictory, but in fact are inextricably intertwined.
Maybe you could talk a little more, because this is of extraordinary interest to me. I hosted a film showing last night, and the thing, of course, that was extraordinary, that about 125 people came out to view this this documentary on the media. And there we were, all face-to-face, and I suggested, if you want, stick around. When the film ended, I said, thank you very much for coming. If you'd like to talk about this or have other ideas about this, it's good that we're all here. This is kind of getting rarer and rarer in societies dominated by video screens. They just all left. I know they liked the movie. I mean, they all applauded, and they all applauded me and everything like that. But it was like, I'm out of here. I don't want to sit around. I mean, I remember when I was a college student even. We'd set up debates between different people, and we'd all meet at this cafeteria and talk about what is reality. Any observations about the state of things today in terms of people not being able to get much space for face-to-face contact?
Well, I think one of the problems is that quite often when people say, hey, let's stick around and talk about this, there's almost this innate tension that rises. There's this expectation that it's going to be, rather than a thoughtful sharing, that people are going to get mad at one another. And if you look at so many of the models, unfortunately, on TV and radio, well, that is what happens. We're trying, through our nonprofit Society for Philosophical Inquiry, to create a very modest alternative where, again, the idea isn't to win anything and that we can all win together by just engaging in a type of reflective discourse where we not only articulate our views, but in fact further discover them simply by sharing our perspectives with others and then giving them a chance to really inspire us to develop our views in a way that we wouldn't typically. So we may leave at the end with more questions that we had at the outset, but that's exhilarating, that's good because it leaves us more inquisitive and curious souls who want to dig in more into the world and gather more frequently with other fellow thoughtful people, especially those who come at things very differently than we do.
Mm-hmm. Christopher Phillips is my guest. The book is Six Questions of Socrates, published by Norton. It's in paper. Also contains a special feature on how to start your own Socrates Cafe. Well, you're going to be in Detroit and Ann Arbor April 21st and 22nd. We'll give the details at the end of this again. But is that going to be a reading, or is it going to be sort of a Socrates Cafe?
Both.
Okay.
I will read a little bit of my book, but it will quickly, hopefully, segue, as it almost always does, into a wonderful, intense mini-dialogue. There are ongoing Socrates Cafe groups, both in Detroit and in Ann Arbor, and that's the reason I insisted to my publisher that they send me there. There are people there who are so concerned about doing what they can to create this grassroots form of democracy. You know, democracy isn't mostly about just going out once every couple years and voting. It's about a deliberative democracy, which is how America started, is about gathering regularly with diverse souls and inquiring regularly with them. And I'm just delighted that there's been these people of conscience, both in Detroit and Ann Arbor, who have taken this responsibility personally. And I'm sort of really looking forward to meeting these great people.
How do you, for instance, with size? I mean, at some point, if you have like 100 people, it gets a little difficult. And how do you stop like big mouth men like me from just dominating the conversation?
Well, one of the things as a facilitator that I do, and our website, philosopher.org, has a comprehensive guide about this, is simply to make sure that the dialogue is well distributed, where people understand from the outset that it's not about having things swirl around you, that if you're going to really grow as a person, then you really want to take pause and need to take pause and consider carefully what others are having to say. I simply don't allow, I have to be rather assertive so that it doesn't just be sort of devolved to a one-on-one just between a couple of people. Because the dialogue is for everybody, and we all lose if everybody who wants to have a chance to speak doesn't have that chance, especially soft-spoken souls who quite often are rather humble, but it's typically their stories that are the most compelling, and it really behooves us to take the time to listen to them.
And actually, you were mentioning earlier about learning to listen, and particularly in my business, maybe some of my personality, which drew me to this business, I came to the realization that I know how to talk. I ought to go for the other end of it, learn how to listen. So I agree with you. That's extraordinarily important. Do you find that there is a distribution, though, of diverse political and philosophical views, or does it turn? I could somehow imagining mostly people with a more liberal bent taking part in all of this.
Well, there certainly are groups where that is the case. I've been deeply heartened by the fact that there are so many groups that really do thrive on the type of diversity, political, spiritual, philosophical, cultural, of which I speak. It's not just about gaining greater multicultural perspectives. It's about gaining greater multi-experiential perspectives. We can all have blonde hair and blue eyes and white skin, but we all occupy different space. So that means that we all look at the world at least somewhat differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really important to give each of us a chance to share our view of the world through our lenses. So, we can open ourselves up to the other. And my contention is that ethnic diversity is one very, very important type, but there's intellectual diversity, spiritual diversity. Even people who are fundamentalists, Christians or Muslims, there's still a very diverse range of people that fall under that rubric. And so it's fascinating to engage in a sharing with people like that, because I wouldn't be doing this still after all these years. I'm very much the unpaid director of our nonprofit group. My wife and I lived without a home for over 4 years, but I'm still doing this because I'm passionate about it, and I've seen how much it's changed people's lives. It's made them more empathetic souls. People who, like me, used to be very, very impatient, didn't really care to hear what others had to say because we were so darn sure that we were right. have had this rather transformative experience. As we listen more to others, we want to listen even more. And that's been a real blessing for me.
That's interesting. I was going to use that identical word, transformative. And we need some answers. At least we need some questions to begin with. And these are posed in Christopher Phillips' new book, Six Questions of Socrates, A Modern-Day Journey of Discovery Through World Philosophy. It's in paper. It's published by Norton. Has a special section on how to start your own Socrates Cafe as well. And if you'd like to see Christopher Phillips in person in our area around here, Borders Books on Woodward in Birmingham on Thursday, April 21st. The following day, Shame and Drum in Ann Arbor, April 22nd. Both of them at 7 p.m., I should say. Talk and signing if you have this book. Christopher Phillips, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
This is WRIF.com.
If you think it's too late in life to earn the college degree you want, listen to this. Now you can go to a college designed for busy working adults. It's University of Phoenix, the nation's largest private accredited university. In most cases, you can earn a bachelor's or master's degree in just 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classroom settings are designed for working adults with busy lives. With their efficient learning model, you'll cover more material in less time, going to convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. For a complimentary brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more, call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Classes are forming, so call now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Anglers, get ready to cast your line for big money this year because the WRAF Fishing Championship Series is coming. The series consists of 4 tournaments this year: walleye, catfish, bass, and muskie. In each tournament, anglers compete for cash and prizes, and the team with the best average finish in the 4 tournament series will also win $1,500 cash, plus the title of 2005 WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champions. After each event, competitors get to kick back and party at Big Al Sports Bar for the awards and more chances to win prizes from the Riff. The first tournament kicks off on April 23rd at the Lake Erie Metro Park for the WRAF Walleye Championship. The teams start their boats at 6:30 a.m. and will weigh their catch at 4 p.m. 2 to 3 person teams compete for thousands in cash and prizes, but one team will finish the day holding the championship trophy. To sign up or to find out about a sponsorship, call 248-591-6841 today or go to WRIF.com to get a registration form. Become the WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Take to the ice with 101 WRIF and Labatt Blues 21 and over Summer Hockey Challenge. Games run in June at rinks across Detroit with a 3-game guarantee. All skill levels are welcome. More info available at WRIF.com or call Suburban Training Center at 248-888-1400. Get hockey with Labatt Blue and 101 WRIF.